Chapter 30. A Wager. A soft night breeze stirred across the small town of Ironrod, then faded. Sitting on the stone rail of the wide flat bridge in the heart of the town, Rand supposed the breeze was hot. It had hardly felt so after the waste. Warm for nighttime, perhaps, but not enough to make him unbutton his red coat. The river below him had never been large, and was half its normal width now, yet he still enjoyed watching the water flow north, moon shadows cast by scudding clouds playing across the darkly glittering surface. That was why he was out here in the night, really, to look at running water for a time. His wards were set, surrounding the Aiel encampment that itself surrounded the town. The Aiel themselves kept a watch a sparrow could not pierce unseen. He could waste an hour being soothed by the flow of a river. It was surely better than another night where he had to order Moraine to leave so he could study with Osmodian. She had even taken to bringing his meals to him and talking while he ate, as if she meant to cram everything she knew into his head before they reached the city of Kyrian. He could not face her begging to remain. Actually begging, as she had the previous night. For a woman like Moraine, that behavior was so unnatural that he had wanted to agree simply to stop it. Which was very likely why she had done it. Much better an hour listening to the quiet, liquid ripplings of the river. With luck, she would have given up on him for tonight. The 8 or 10 paces of clay between water and weeds on both sides below him was dried and cracked. He peered up at the clouds crossing the moon. He could try to make those clouds give rain. The town's two fountains were both dry, and dust lay in a third of the wells not fouled beyond cleaning. Try was the word, though. He had made it rain once. Remembering how was the trick. If he managed that, then he could try not to make it a drowning deluge and a tree-snapping windstorm this time. Osmodian would be no help. He did not know much about weather, it seemed. For everything the man taught him, there were two more that made Osmodian either throw up his hands or give a lick and a promise. Once he had thought that the Forsaken knew everything, that they were all but omnipotent. But if the others were like Osmodian, they had ignorances as well as weaknesses. It might actually be that he already knew more of some things than they. Than some of them, at least. The problem would be finding out who. Semirag was almost as poor at handling weather as Osmodian. He shivered as if this were night in a threefold land. Osmodian had never told him that. Better to listen to the water and not think, if he meant to sleep at all tonight. Sulin approached him, the shufa around her shoulders so it uncovered her short white hair, and leaned on the railing. The wiry maiden was armed for battle, bow and arrows, spears and knife and buckler. She had taken command of his bodyguard tonight. 2 dozen more, Farder Eyes Mai, squatted easily on the bridge 10 paces away.
"An odd night," she said. "We were gambling, but suddenly everyone was throwing nothing but sixes."
"I'm sorry," he told her without thinking, and she gave him a peculiar look. She did not know, of course. He had not spread it about. The ripples he gave off as Taviran spread out in odd, random ways. Even the Aiel would not want to be within 10 miles of him if they knew. The ground had given way beneath 3 stone dogs today, dropping them into a viper pit, but none of the dozens of bites had found anything but cloth. He knew that had been him, bending chance. Talnethan, the saddlemaker, had survived Tyan to trip on a stone this very noon and break his neck, falling on flat, grassy ground. Rand was afraid that had been him, too. On the other hand, Bale and Geron had mended the blood feud between the Sharad and the Goshin while he was with them, eating a midday meal of dried meat on the move. They still did not like each other and hardly seemed to understand what they had done, but it was done, with pledges and water oaths given, each man holding the cup for the other to drink. To Aiel, water oaths were stronger than any other. It might be generations before Sharad and Goshin so much as raided each other for sheep or goats or cattle.
He had wondered if those random effects would ever work in his favor. Maybe this was as close as it came. What else had happened today that might be laid at his feet, he did not know. He never asked, and would as soon not hear. The Bales and Gerons could only partly make up for the Tall Nethans. "I've not seen Anila or Adeline for days," he said. It was as good a change of subject as any. That pair in particular had seemed to be jealous of their places guarding him. "Are they ill?" If anything, the look Sulin gave him was even more peculiar. "They will return when they learn to stop playing with dolls, Randall Thor." He opened his mouth, then closed it again. Aiel were strange. Avienda's lessons often made them more so, not less. But this was ridiculous. "Well, tell them they are grown women, and they ought to act it." Even by moonlight, he could tell that her smile was pleased. "It shall be as the Kar Karn wishes." What did that mean? She eyed him a moment, lips pursed thoughtfully. "You have not eaten yet tonight. There is still enough food for everyone. And you will not fill one belly by going hungry yourself. If you do not eat, people will worry that you are ill. You will become ill." He laughed softly, a hoarse wheeze. The Kar Karn one minute, and the next. If he did not fetch something to eat, Sulin would probably go get it for him, and try to feed him to boot. "I will eat." Moraine must be in her blankets by now. This time her odd look was satisfying. For a change, he had said something that she did not understand. As he swung his feet down, he heard the ring of horses' hooves walking down the stone-paved street toward the bridge. Every maiden was upright in an instant, face veiled, half-knocked arrows. His hand went to his waist by instinct, but the sword was not there. The Aiel felt strange enough about him riding a horse and carrying the thing at his saddle. He had not seen any need to offend their customs more by wearing it. Besides, there were not many horses, and they were coming at a walk. When they appeared, surrounded by an escort of 50 Aiel, the riders numbered fewer than 20, slumping in their saddles dejectedly. Most wore rimmed helmets and Tyrin coats with puffy striped sleeves beneath their breastplates. The pair in the lead had ornately gilded cuirasses and large white plumes attached to the front of their helmets, and the stripes on their sleeves had the glisten of satin in the moonlight. Half a dozen men at the rear, though shorter and slighter than the Tyrans, two with small banners called Khan on short staffs harnessed to their backs, wore dark coats and helmets shaped like bells cut away to expose their faces. Kyrianen used the banners to pick out officers in battle, and also to mark a lord's personal retainers. The Tyrans, with plumes, stared when they saw him, exchanged startled glances, then scrambled down to come kneel before him, helmets under their arms. They were young, little older than he, both with dark beards trimmed to neat points in the fashion of Tyran nobility. Dents marred their breastplates, and the gilding was chipped. They had been crossing swords somewhere. Neither as much as glanced at the Aiel surrounding them, as if when ignored they would disappear. The maidens unveiled, though they looked no less ready to put a spear or arrow through the kneeling men. Ruark followed the Tyrans, with a gray-eyed Aiel younger and slightly taller than he, and stood behind. Mangan was of the Jindo Tardad, and one of those who had gone to the Stone of Tyr. Jindo had brought in the riders.
"My lord dragon," the plump, pink-cheeked lordling said. "Burn my soul, but have they taken you prisoner?"
His companion, jug-ears and potato-nose, making him look like a farmer despite his beard, kept sweeping lanky hair from his forehead nervously.
"They said they were taking us to some Dawn fellow. The Kar Karn means something about chiefs, if I remember what my tutor said. Forgive me, my lord dragon. I am a Dorian of House Salona, and this is Estion of House Andiyama."
"I am he who comes with the dawn," Rand told them quietly, "and the Kar Karn." He had them placed now, young lords who had spent their time drinking, gambling, and chasing women when he was in the stone.
Estian's eyes nearly popped out of his face. Dorian looked surprised for a moment, then nodded slowly, as if he suddenly saw how it made sense.
"Stand. Who are your Kyrianan companions?"
It would be interesting to meet Kyrianan, who were not running for their lives from the Shido, and any other Aiel they saw. For that matter, if they were with Dorian and Estian, they might be the first supporters he had met in this land. If the two tyrants' fathers had followed his orders.
"Bring them forward."
Estian blinked in surprise as he rose, but Dorian barely paused in turning to shout,
"Miracin! Darricane! Come here!"
Much like calling dogs. The Kyrianans' banners bobbed as they dismounted slowly.
"My lord dragon,"
Estian hesitated, licking his lips as though thirsty.
Did you send the Aiel against Kyrian?"
"They've attacked the city, then?"
Ruark nodded, and Mangan said,
"If these are to be believed, Kyrian still holds, or did 3 days ago."
There was little doubt that he did not think it still did, unless that he cared about a city of tree-killers.
"I did not send them, Estian," Rand said, as they were joined by the two Kyrianan, who knelt, doffing their helmets to reveal men of an age with Dorian and Estian, their hair shaved back in line with their ears, and their dark eyes wary. "Those who attack the city are my enemies, the Shido. I mean to save Kyrian, if it can be saved."
He had to go through the business of telling the Kyrianan to rise. His time with the Aiel had almost made him forget the habit this side of the spine of the world, bowing and kneeling right and left. He had to ask for introductions, too, and the Kyrianan gave them themselves. "Lieutenant Lord Miracin of House Dagonred." His con was all wavy vertical lines of red and white. "And Lieutenant Lord Darricane of House Annalyn." His con covered with small squares of red and black. It was a surprise that they were lords. Though lords commanded and led soldiers in Kyrian, they did not shave their heads and become soldiers. Or had not. Much had changed, apparently.
"My lord dragon."
Miracin stumbled a bit saying that. He and Darricane were both pale, slender men, with narrow faces and long noses, but he was a bit the heavier. Neither looked as if he had had much to eat lately. Miracin rushed on as if afraid of being interrupted.
"My lord dragon, Kyrian can hold, for days yet, perhaps as many as 10 or 12, but you must come quickly if you are to save it."
"That is why we came out," Estian said, shooting Miracin a dark look.
Both Kyrianan returned it, but their defiance was tinged with resignation. Estian raked stringy hair from his forehead.
"To find help. Parties have been sent in every direction, my lord dragon."
He shivered despite the sweat on his brow, and his voice turned distant and hollow.
"There were more of us when we started. I saw Baron go down, screaming with a spear through his guts. He'll never turn a card at chop again. I could use a mug of strong brandy."
Dorian turned his helmet in gauntleted hands, frowning.
"My lord dragon, the city can hold a while longer, but even if these Aiel will fight those, the question is, can you bring them there in time?
I think 10 or 12 days is a more than generous estimate myself. In truth, I only came because I thought dying with a spear through me would be better than being taken alive when they made it over the walls. The city is packed with refugees who fled ahead of the Aiel. There isn't a dog or a pigeon left in the city, and I doubt there will be a rat left soon. The one good thing is that no one seems to be worrying very much about who will take the Sun Throne, not with this Cooladin outside.
He called on us to surrender to he who comes with the dawn on the second day," Darricane put in, earning a sharp look from Dorian for the interruption.
"Cooladin has some sport with prisoners," Estian said, "out of bowshot, but where anyone on the walls can see. You can hear them screaming, too. The light burn my soul. I don't know whether he is trying to break our will, or simply likes it.
Sometimes they let peasants make a run for the city, then shoot them full of arrows when they're almost safe. However safe Kyrian is. Only peasants, but... His voice trailed off and swallowed hard, as if he had just remembered what Rand's opinions were of only peasants. Rand just looked at him, but he seemed to shrivel, and muttered under his breath about brandy. Edorian leaped into the momentary silence.
"My lord dragon, the point is that the city can hold until you come, if you can come quickly. We only beat back the first assault before the foregate caught fire."
"Flames nearly took the city," Estion interjected. The foregate, a city in itself outside the walls of Kyrian, had been mostly wood, as Rand remembered.
"Would have been disaster if the river was not right there."
The other tyrant went on right over him.
"But Lord Mylan has the defense well planned, and the Kyrian appear to be keeping their backbones for the time."
That earned him frowns from Myrison and Darricane, that he either did not see or pretended not to.
7 days with luck, perhaps 8 at the most. If you can...
A heavy sigh abruptly seemed to deflate Adorian's plumpness.
"I did not see one horse," he said as if to himself. "The Aiel do not ride. You will never be able to move men afoot so far in time."
"How long?" Rand asked Ruark.
7 days, was the reply. Magnan nodded, and Estion laughed.
"Burn my soul! It took us as long to reach here on horses. If you think you can make the return in the same afoot, you must be—"
Becoming aware of the Aiel eyes on him, Estion scrubbed the hair from his face.
"Is there any brandy in this town?" he muttered.
"It isn't how fast we can make it," Rand said quietly, "but how fast you can, if you dismount some of your men and use their horses for spares. I want to let Mylan and Kyrian know that help is on the way. But whoever goes will have to be sure he can keep his mouth shut if the Shido take him. I do not intend to let Culloden know any more than he can learn on his own." Estion went whiter in the face than the Kyrianin. Myrison and Darricane were on their knees together, each seizing one of Rand's hands to kiss. He let them, with as much patience as he could find. One bit of Moraine's advice that had the ring of common sense was not to offend people's customs, however strange or even repulsive, unless you absolutely had to, and even then think twice.
"We will go, my lord dragon," Myrison said breathlessly. "Thank you, my lord dragon, thank you. Under the light, I vow I will die before revealing a word to any but my father or the High Lord Mylan." "Grace favor you, my lord dragon," the other added. "Grace favor you, and the light illumine you forever. I am your man to the death."
Rand let Myrison say that he was also Rand's man before taking his hands back firmly and telling them to stand. He did not like the way they were looking at him. Edorian had called them like hounds, but men should not look at anyone as if they were dogs gazing at a master. Edorian drew a deep breath, puffing his pink cheeks, and let it out slowly.
"I suppose if I made it out in one piece, I can make it back in. My lord dragon, forgive me if I offend, but would you care to wager, say, 1,000 gold crowns, that you can really come in 7 days?"
Rand stared at him. The man was as bad as Matt.
"I don't have 100 crowns silver, much less 1,000 in—"
Sulin broke in.
"He has it, Tyrin," she said firmly. "He will meet your wager, if you make it 10,000 by weight."
Edorian laughed.
"Done, Aiel, and worth every copper if I lose. Come to think, I'll not live to collect if I win."
"Come, Myrison, Darricane."
It sounded as if he were summoning dogs to heel.
"We ride."
Rand waited until the three had made their bows and were halfway back to the horses before rounding on the white-haired maiden.
"What do you mean I have 1,000 gold crowns? I've never seen 1,000 crowns, much less 10,000.
The maidens exchanged glances as if he were demented. So did Ruark and Mangan.
"A fifth of the treasure that was in the Stone of Tyr belongs to those who took the stone, and will be claimed when they can carry it away,"
Sulin spoke as to a child, instructing it in the simple facts of everyday life.
As chief and battle leader there, one-tenth of that fifth is yours. Tyr submitted to you as chief by right of triumph, so one-tenth of Tyr is yours as well. And you have said we can take the fifth in these lands. Tax, you called it.
She fumbled the word. The Aiel did not have taxes.
The tenth part of that is yours also, as Ka'akarn.
Rand shook his head.
In all of his talks with Avienda, he had never thought to ask whether the fifth applied to him. He was not Aiel, Ka'akarn or no, and it had not seemed anything to do with him.
Well, it might not be a tax, but he could use it as kings did taxes. Unfortunately, he had only the vaguest idea how that was. He would have to ask Moraine. That was one thing she had missed in her lectures. Perhaps she thought it was so obvious that he should know.
Elaine would have known what taxes were used for. It had certainly been more fun taking advice from her than from Moraine.
He wished he knew where she was.
Still in Tanchico, probably. Egwene told him little more than a constant string of well-wishings. He wished he could sit Elaine down and make her explain those two letters. Maiden of the Spear or Daughter Heir of Andor. Women were strange. Except maybe men. She had laughed at him, but she had never made him think she was speaking some strange language. She would not laugh now. If he ever saw her again, she would run 100 miles to get away from the Dragon Reborn.
Adorian dismounted all his men, taking one of their horses and stringing the others together by their reins, along with Estion's. No doubt he was saving his own for the final sprint through the Shido. Mirasin and Darrakane did the same with their men. Though it meant that the Cariennan had only 2 spare mounts apiece, no one seemed to think they should have any of the Tyran horses. They clattered off together westward at a trot, with a Jindo escort.
Carefully not looking at anyone, Estion started to drift toward the soldiers standing uneasily in a circle of Aiel at the foot of the bridge. Mangan caught his red-striped sleeve.
"You can tell us conditions inside Carrion, Wetlander."
The lumpy-faced man looked ready to faint.
"I am certain he will answer any questions you ask," Rand said sharply, emphasizing the final word.
"They will only be asked," Ruark said, taking the Tyran's other arm.
He and Mangan seemed to be holding the much shorter man up between them.
"Warning the city's defenders is well and good, Randalthor," Ruark went on. "But we should send scouts. Running, they can reach Carrion as soon as those men on horses, and meet us coming back with word of how Culloden has disposed the Shido."
Rand could feel the maiden's eyes on him, but he looked straight at Ruark.
"Thunderwalkers," he suggested.
"Shamad Kanda," Ruark agreed.
He and Mangan turned Estion. They were holding him up, and started toward the other soldiers.
"Ask," Rand called after them. "He is your ally, and my liegeman."
He had no idea whether Estion was that last or not. It was another thing to ask Moraine. Or even how much of an ally he really was. His father, the High Lord Torion, had plotted against Rand enough, but he would allow nothing close to Culloden's ways. Ruark turned his head and nodded.
"You tend your people well, Randalthor."
Sulin's voice was flat as a plain plank.
"I try," he told her.
He was not about to rise to the bait. Whoever went to scout the Shido, some would not return, and that was that. "I think I will have something to eat now and get some sleep." It could not be much more than 2 hours to midnight, and sunrise still came early this time of year. The maidens followed him, watching the shadows warily as if they expected attack, hand talk flickering among them. But then, Aiel always seemed to expect attack. Chapter 31 The Far Snows. The streets of Ironrod ran straight and met at right angles,
were necessary slicing through hills that were otherwise neatly terraced with stone. The slate-roofed stone buildings had an angular look, as if they were all vertical lines. Ironrod had not fallen to Culloden. No people had been there when the Shido swept through. A good many of the houses were only charred beams and hollow, ruined shells, however, including most of the wide three-story marble buildings with balconies that Moraine had said belonged to merchants. Broken furniture and clothes littered the streets, along with shattered dishes and shards of glass from windows, single boots and tools and toys. The burning had come at different times. Rand could tell that much himself, from the weathering of blackened timbers and how much smell of char lingered where. But Lan had been able to chart the flow of battles by which the town had been taken and retaken. By different houses contending for the Sun Throne, most likely, though from the look of the streets, the last to hold Ironrod, had been brigands. A good many of the bands roaming Kyrian held allegiance to no one and to nothing except gold. It was to one of the merchants' houses that Rand went, on the largest of the town's two squares, three square stories of gray marble with heavy balconies and wide steps with thick angular stone side rails, overlooking a silent fountain with a dusty round basin. A chance to sleep in a bed again had been too good to pass up, and he had hopes that Avienda would choose to remain in a tent. Whether his or with the wise ones, he did not care, so long as he did not have to try going to sleep while listening to her breathe a few paces away. Recently he had begun imagining he could hear her heartbeat, even when he had not taken hold of Saidin. But if she did not stay away, he had taken precautions. The maidens stopped at the steps, some trotting around the building to take positions on all sides. He had feared that they would try declaring this a roof of the maidens, even for one night. And so as soon as he had chosen the building, one of the few in town with a sound roof and most of the windows unbroken, he had told Sulin that he was declaring it the roof of the Winespring brothers. No one could enter who had not drunk from the Winespring in Emmons Field. From the look she had given him, she knew very well what he was up to, but none of them followed him beyond the wide doors that seemed to be all narrow vertical panels. Inside, the large rooms were bare, though white-robed Guy Shine had spread a few blankets for themselves in the broad entry hall. Its high plaster ceiling worked in a pattern of severe squares. Keeping Guy Shine out was beyond him, even had he wanted to, as much so as keeping Moraine out if she was not asleep elsewhere. Whatever orders he gave about not being disturbed, she always found a way to make the maidens let her by, and it always took a direct command for her to go before she would leave. The Guy Shine rose smoothly, men and women, before he had the door closed. They would not sleep until he did, and some would take turns remaining awake in case he wanted something in the night. He had tried ordering them not to, but telling a Guy Shine not to serve according to custom was like kicking a bale of wool. Whatever impression you made was gone as soon as your toes were. He waved them away and climbed the marble stairs. Some of those Guy Shine had salvaged a few bits of furniture, including a bed and two feather mattresses, and he was looking forward to washing and... He froze as soon as he opened the door to his bedchamber. Avienda had not chosen to remain with the tents. She stood before the washstand with its mismatched cracked bowl and pitcher, a cloth in one hand and a bar of yellow soap in the other. She had no clothes on. She seemed as stunned as he, as incapable of moving. She stopped to swallow, big green eyes locked on his face. I could not make a sweat tent here in this town, so I thought I would try your way of... She was hard muscle and soft curves. She glistened damply from head to feet. He had never imagined that her legs were so long. I thought you would remain longer at the bridge. Her voice rose in pitch, her eyes widened in panic. I did not arrange for you to see me. I must get away from you. As far away as I can. I must. Suddenly, a shimmering vertical line appeared in the air near her. It widened as if rotating into a gateway. Icy wind rushed through it into the room, carrying thick curtains of snow. I must get away, she wailed, and darted through into the blizzard. Immediately the gateway began to narrow again, turning. But without thought, Rand channeled, blocking it at half its former width. He did not know what he had done or how, but he was sure this was a gateway for traveling, such as Asmodian had told him of, and been unable to teach him. There was no time for thinking. Wherever Avienda had gone, she had gone naked into the heart of a winter storm. Rand tied off the flows he had woven as he ripped all the blankets from the bed and tossed them onto her clothes and pallet. Seizing blankets, clothes, and rugs altogether, he plunged through, only moments behind her. Icy wind screamed through night air filled with swirling white. Even wrapped in the void, he could feel his body shivering. Dimly he could make out scattered shapes in the darkness. Trees, he thought. There was nothing for him to smell but cold. Ahead of him, a form moved, obscured by darkness and the snowstorm. He might have missed it, but for the sharpness of his eyes in the void. Avienda, running as hard as she could. He lumbered after her through snow to his knees, clutching the thick bundle to his chest. "Avienda, stop!" He was afraid that the howling wind would sweep his shout away, but she heard. And if anything, ran faster. He forced himself to more speed, staggering and tripping as the deepening snow tugged at his boots. The prints left by her bare feet were filling fast. If he lost sight of her in this... "Stop, you fool woman! Are you trying to kill yourself?" The sound of his voice seemed to flog her to run harder. Grimly, he pushed himself, half falling and scrambling back up, knocked down by the hurtling wind, as often as stumbling in the snow, blundering into trees. He had to keep his eyes on her. He was only thankful this forest, or whatever it was, had trees so far apart. Plans skittered across the void and were discarded. He could try quelling the storm, and maybe the result would be to turn the air to ice. A shelter of air to keep the falling snow away would do nothing for that underfoot. He could melt a path for himself with fire and slog through mud instead. Unless... He channeled, and the snow ahead of him melted in a band a span wide, a band that ran ahead of him as he did. Steam rose, and falling snow vanished a foot above the sandy soil. He could feel the heat of it through his boots. Down almost to his ankles, his body shook with the bone-chilling cold. His feet sweated and flinched away from the heated ground. But he was catching up now. Another 5 minutes, and... Suddenly the vague shape he had been following vanished, as if she had fallen into a hole. Keeping his eyes fixed on the spot where he had last seen her, he ran as hard as he could. Abruptly, he was splashing in icy, flowing water to his ankles, halfway to his knees. Ahead of him, the melting snow revealed more, and an edge of ice inching slowly back. No steam rose from the black water. Stream or river, it was too big for the amount of his channeling to warm the swift-moving flow even a hair. She must have run out onto the ice and fallen through. But he would not save her by trying to wade into this. Filled with sidine, he was barely aware of the cold, but his teeth chattered uncontrollably. Retreating to the bank, gaze locked on where he thought Avienda had gone down, he channeled flows of fire into the ground still bare, well back from the stream, until the sand melted and fused and glowed white. Even in this storm, that would stay hot for a time. He set the bundle down in the snow beside it. Her life would depend on finding the blankets and rugs again. Then waded through the deep white to one side of the melted path and lay flat. Slowly he crawled out onto the snow-covered ice. The wind shrieked across him. His coat might as well not have existed. His hands were numb now, and his feet going. He had stopped shivering except for an occasional shudder. Coldly calm inside the void, he knew what was happening. There were blizzards in the two rivers, perhaps even as bad as this. His body was being overwhelmed. If he did not find warmth soon, he would be able to calmly watch from the void as he died. But if he died, Avienda would too, if she had not already. He felt rather than heard the ice cracking beneath his weight. His probing hands fell into water. This was the place. But with snow whirling about, he could barely see. He flailed, searching, numb hands splashing. One hit something at the edge of the ice, and he commanded his fingers to close, felt frozen hair crackling.
Got to pull her out.
He crawled backward, hauling at her. She was a dead weight, sliding slowly out of the water.
Don't care if the ice scrapes her. Better that than freezing or drowning. Back. Keep moving. If you quit, she dies. Keep moving, burn you.
Crawling. Pulling with his legs. Pushing with one hand. The other locked in Avienda's hair. No time to get a better grip. She could not feel it anyway.
You've had it easy for too long. Lord's kneeling and Guy Shine running to fetch your wine and Moraine doing as she's told. Back. Time to do something yourself if you still can. Move, you flaming fatherless son of a spavined goat. Keep moving.
Suddenly, his feet hurt. The pain began creeping up his legs. It took him a moment to look back, and then he rolled off the steaming patch of melted sand. Tendrils of smoke, where his breeches had begun smoldering, were whisked away by the wind. Fumbling for the bundle he had left, he swathed Avienda from head to foot in all of it, the blankets, the rugs of her pallet, her clothes. Every bit of protection was vital. Her eyes were closed, and she did not move. He parted the blankets enough to put an ear to her chest. Her heart beat so slowly that he was not sure he was really hearing it. Even four blankets and half a dozen rugs were not enough, and he could not channel heat into her as he had the ground. Even finding the flow as much as possible, he was more likely to kill than warm. He could feel the weave he had used to block open her gateway, a mile or perhaps two away through the storm. If he tried to carry her that far, neither of them would survive. They needed shelter, and they needed it here. He channeled flows of air, and snow began to move across the ground against the wind, building into thick, square walls, three paces on a side, with one gap for a door, building higher, compacting the snow till it glistened like ice, roofing it over high enough to stand. Scooping Avienda into his arms, he stumbled into the dark interior, weaving and tying flames dancing in the corners for light, channeling to scoop more snow to close the doorway. Just with the wind shut away, it felt warmer, but that would not be enough. Using the trick Osmodian had shown him, he wove air and fire, and the air around them grew warmer. He did not dare tie that weave off. If he fell asleep, it could grow and melt the hut. For that matter, the flames were almost as dangerous to leave, but he was too bone-weary and chilled to maintain more than one weave. The ground inside had been cleared as he built, bare sandy soil with only a few brown leaves he did not recognize, and some scruffy, low, dead weeds that were equally strange to him. Releasing the weave that warmed the air, he heated the ground enough to take away the iciness, then took up the other weave again. It was all he could do to lay Avienda down gently, rather than drop her. He pushed a hand inside the blankets to feel her cheek, her shoulder. Trickles of water ran across her face as her hair melted. He was cold, but she was ice. She needed every scrap of warmth he could find for her, and he did not dare warm the air more. Already the insides of the walls shone with a faint layer of melt. However frozen he felt, he had more heat in him than she did. Stripping off his clothes, he climbed into the coverings with her, arranging his own damp garments on the outside. They could help hold in the body heat. His sense of touch, enhanced by the void and Sidene, soaked in the feel of her. Her skin made silk feel rough. Compared to her skin, satin was... Don't think. He smoothed damp hair away from her face. He should have dried it, but the water no longer felt so cold, and there was nothing but the blankets or their clothes to use anyway. Her eyes were closed. Her chest stirred against him slowly. Her head lay on his arm, snuggled against his chest. If she had not felt like winter itself, she could have been sleeping. So peaceful, not angry at all. So beautiful. Stop thinking. It was a sharp command outside the emptiness surrounding him. Talk. He tried talking of the first thing that came to mind. Elaine, and the confusion her two letters brought. But that soon had thoughts of golden-haired Elaine drifting across the void, of kissing her in secluded spots in the stone.
"Don't think of kissing, fool."
He shifted to Min. He had never thought about Min that way. Well, a few dreams could not count. Min would have slapped his face if he ever tried to kiss her, or else laughed and called him a woolhead. Only it seemed that speaking of any woman reminded him that he had his arms around a woman who had no clothes on. Filled with the power, he could smell the scent of her, feel every inch of her as clearly as if he were running his hands. The void trembled.
"Light, you're only trying to warm her. Keep your mind out of the pigsty, man."
Trying to drive thought away, he talked of his hopes for Kyrian, to bring peace and an end to the famine, to bring the nations behind him without any more bloodshed. But that had its own life, too, its own inevitable path to Sheol Ghul, where he must face the Dark One and die, if the prophecies were true. It seemed cowardly to say that he hoped he might live through that somehow. Aiel did not know cowardice. The worst of them was brave as a lion.
"The breaking of the world killed the weak," he had heard Bale say, "and the threefold land killed the cowards."
He began speaking of where they might be, where she had brought them with her wild, senseless flight. Somewhere far and strange to have snow at this time of year. It had been worse than a senseless flight. Mad. Yet he knew that she had fled from him. Fled from him. How she must hate him, if she had to flee as far as she could, rather than just tell him to leave her to her bath in privacy. "I should have knocked."
At his own bedroom door?
"I know you do not want to be around me. You don't have to be. Whatever the wise ones want, whatever they say, you are going back to their tents. You will not have to come near me again. In fact, if you do, I'll send you away."
Why hesitate on that?
She gave him anger, coldness, bitterness when she was awake and asleep. It was a crazy thing to do. You could have killed yourself.
He was stroking her hair again. He could not seem to stop.
"If you ever do anything half so crazy again, I'll break your neck. Do you have any idea how I will miss hearing you breathe at night?"
Miss it? She drove him crazy with it. He was the one who was mad. He had to stop this.
"You are going away, and that's that. If I have to send you back to Roydion. The wise ones can't stop me if I speak as Kaa Karn. You won't have to run away from me again."
The hand that he could not stop from stroking her hair froze as she stirred. She was warm, he realized. Very warm.
He should be wrapping one of the blankets about himself decently and moving away.
Her eyes opened, clear and deep green, staring at him seriously from not a foot away. She did not seem surprised to see him, and she did not pull back. He took his arms from around her, started to slither away, and she seized a handful of his hair in a painful grip. If he moved, he would have a bald patch. She gave him no chance to explain anything.
"I promised my near sister to watch you."
She seemed to be speaking to herself as much to him, in a low, almost expressionless voice.
"I ran from you as hard as I could to shield my honor. And you followed me even here. The rings do not lie, and I can run no more."
Her tone firmed decisively.
"I will run no more."
Rand tried to ask her what she meant while attempting to untangle her fingers from his hair, but she clutched another handful on the other side and pulled his mouth to hers. That was the end of rational thought. The void shattered and Saidin fled. He did not think he could have stopped himself had he wanted to. Only he could not think of wanting to, and she certainly did not seem to want him to. In fact, the last thought he had of any coherency for a very long time was that he did not think he could have stopped her. Some considerable time later, 2 hours, maybe three, he could hardly be sure, he lay atop the rugs with the blankets over him and his hands behind his head, watching Avienda examine the slick white walls. They had held a surprising amount of the warmth. There was no need to latch onto Saidin again, either to shut out cold or to try warming the air. She had done no more than rake her fingers through her hair on rising, and she moved completely unashamed at her nakedness. Of course, it was a bit late to be ashamed of something as small as having no clothes on. He had been worried about hurting her when dragging her out of the water, but she showed fewer scrapes than he did, and somehow they did not seem to mar her beauty at all.
"What is this?" she asked.
"Snow." He explained what snow was as best he could, but she only shook her head, partly in wonderment, partly in disbelief. For someone who had grown up in the waste, frozen water falling from the sky must seem as impossible as flying. According to the records, the only time it had ever even rained in the waste was the time he had made it. He could not stop a sigh of regret when she began pulling her shift over her head. "The wise ones can marry us as soon as we get back." He could still feel his weave holding her gateway open. Avienda's dark reddish head popped through the neck of the shift and stared at him flatly. Not unfriendly, but not friendly either. Determined, though.
"What makes you think a man has the right to ask me that? Besides, you belong to Elaine."
After a moment, he managed to close his mouth.
"Avienda, we just... the two of us... Light, we have to marry now. Not that I'm doing it because I have to," he added hastily. "I want to."
He was not sure of that at all, really. He thought he might love her, but he thought he might love Elaine, too. And for some reason, Min kept creeping in.
"You're as big a lecher as Matt."
But for once, he could do what was right because it was right. She sniffed at him and felt her stockings to be sure they were dry, then sat down to don them.
"Egwene has spoken to me of your Two Rivers marriage customs."
"You want to wait a year?"
he asked incredulously.
"The year? Yes, that is what I meant."
He had never realized before how much leg a woman showed pulling on a stocking. Odd that that could seem so thrilling after he had seen her naked and sweating and... He concentrated on listening to her.
"Egwene said she thought of asking her mother's permission for you, but before she mentioned it, her mother told her she had to wait another year, even if she did have her hair in a braid."
Avienda frowned, one knee almost under her chin.
"Is that right? She said a girl was not allowed to braid her hair until she was old enough to marry. Do you understand what I am saying? You look like that fish Moraine caught in the river."
There were no fish in the waste. Aiel knew them only from books.
"Of course I do," he said.
He might as well have been deaf and blind for all he understood. Shifting under the blankets, he made himself sound as sure as he could manage.
"At least... well, the customs are complicated, and I am not certain which part you are talking about."
She looked at him suspiciously for a moment, but Aiel customs were so intricate that she believed him. "In the Two Rivers, you walked out for a year, and if you suited, then you became betrothed and finally married." That was as far as custom went. She went on as she dressed.
I meant about a girl asking her mother's permission during the year, and the wisdoms. I cannot say I understand that."
The white blouse going over her head muffled her words for a moment.
"If she wants him, and she is old enough to marry, why should she need permission?"
"But you see, by my customs..."
Her tone of voice said they were the only ones that mattered.
"It is my place to choose whether to ask you, and I will not." "By your customs..."
Fastening her belt, she shook her head dismissively.
"I did not have my mother's permission. And you would need your father's, I suppose, or your father-brother's, since your father is dead. We did not have them, so we cannot marry."
She began folding the scarf to wrap around her forehead.
"I see," he said weakly.
Any boy in the Two Rivers who asked his father for that kind of permission was asking to have his ears soundly boxed. When he thought of the lads who had sweated themselves silly, worrying that someone, anyone, would find out what they were doing with the girl they meant to marry. For that matter, he remembered when Nynaeve caught Kimri Lewin and Barr Dowtry in Barr's father's hayloft. Kimri had had her hair braided for 5 years, but when Nynaeve was through with her, Mistress Lewin had taken over. The women's circle had nearly skinned poor Barr alive, and that was nothing to what they had done to Kimri over the month they thought was the shortest decent time to wait for a wedding. The joke, told quietly, where it would not get to the women's circle, had been that neither Barr nor Kimri had been able to sit down the whole first week they were married. Rand supposed Kimri had failed to ask permission. "But I guess Egwene wouldn't know all the men's customs, after all," he continued. "Women don't know everything. You see, since I started it, we have to marry. It doesn't matter about permissions."
"You started it?"
Her sniff was pointed and meaning. "Aiel, Andrin, or anything else, women use those noises like sticks to prod or thump."
"It does not matter anyway, since we are going by Aiel customs."
This will not happen again, Randall Thor.
He was surprised, and pleased, to hear regret in her voice.
"You belong to the near sister of my near sister. I have toe to Elaine now, but that is none of your concern."
"Are you going to lie there forever?"
"I have heard that men turn lazy after, but it cannot be long until the clans are ready to begin the morning's march. You must be there."
Suddenly a stricken look crossed her face, and she sagged to her knees.
"If we can return. I am not certain that I remember what I did to make the hole, Randall Thor. You must find our way back."
He told her how he had blocked her gateway and could still feel it holding. She looked relieved and even smiled at him. But it became increasingly clear as she folded her legs and arranged her skirts that she did not mean to turn her back while he dressed.
"Fair's fair," he muttered after a long moment, and scrambled out of the blankets.
He tried to be as nonchalant as she had been, but it was not easy. He could feel her eyes like a touch even when he turned away from her. She had no call to tell him he had a pretty behind. He had not said anything about how pretty hers was. She only said it to make him blush anyway. Women did not look at men that way.
"And they don't ask their mother's permission to..."
He had an idea that life with Avienda had not become one bit easier. Chapter 32, A Short Spear. There was little discussion. Even if the storm still raged outside, they could make it back to the gateway using the blankets and rugs for cloaks. Avienda began dividing them while he seized Sidene, filling himself with life and death, molten fire and liquid ice. "Split them equally," he told her. He knew his voice was cold and emotionless. Asmodian had said he could go beyond that, but he had not managed to so far. She gave him a surprised look, but all she said was,
"There is more of you to cover,"
and went on as she was. There was no point in arguing. In his experience from Emmons Field to the Maidens, if a woman wanted to do something for you, the only way to stop her was to tie her up, especially if it involved sacrifice on her part. The surprise was that she had not sounded acid, had not said anything about him being a soft wetlander. Maybe something good besides a memory had come out of this.
"She can't really mean never again."
He suspected that she meant exactly that, though. Weaving a finger-thin flow of fire, he sliced the outline of a door in one wall, widening the gap at the top. Startlingly, daylight shone through. Releasing Sidene, he exchanged surprised looks with Avienda. He knew he had lost track of time. You lost track of the year. But they could not have been inside that long. Wherever they were, it was a great distance from Kyrian.
He pushed against the block, but it did not budge until he put his back into it, dug in his heels, and shoved with all of his might. Just as it occurred to him that he very probably could have done this more easily with the power, the block toppled outward, taking him with it into cold, crisp, pale daylight. Not all the way, though. It stopped at an angle, propped against snow that had built up around the hut. Lying on his back, with only a bit of his head sticking out, he could see other mounds, some smooth drifts around sparse, stunted trees that he did not recognize, others maybe burying bushes or boulders. He opened his mouth and forgot what he was going to say as something swept through the air not 50 feet above him. A leathery gray shape, far bigger than a horse, on slow, beating, widespread wings. A horny snout thrust out before, and clawed feet and thin, lizard-like tail trailing behind. His head twisted on its own to follow the thing's flight over the trees. There were two people on its back. Despite what seemed to be some sort of hooded garments, it was plain that they were scanning the ground below. If he had had more than his head showing, if he had not been directly under the creature, they would surely have seen him. "Leave the blankets," he said, as he ducked back inside. He told her what he had seen. Maybe they'd be friendly and maybe not, but I'd as soon not find out. He was not sure he wanted to meet people who rode something like that in any case, if they were people. "We are going to sneak back to the gateway. As quickly as we can, but sneaking." For a wonder, she did not argue. When he commented on it, as he was helping her climb over the ice block, that was a wonder, too. She accepted his hand without so much as a glare. She said, "I do not argue when you make sense, Randall Thor." That was hardly the way he remembered it. The land around them lay flat beneath its deep blanket of snow, but to the west, sharp, white-tipped mountains rose, peaks wreathed in cloud. He had no difficulty knowing they lay west, for the sun was rising. Less than half its golden ball stuck above the ocean. He stared at that. The land slanted down enough for him to see waves crashing in violent spray on a rocky, boulder-strewn shore maybe half a mile away. An ocean to the east, stretching endlessly to the horizon and sun. If the snow had not been enough, that told him they were in no land he knew. Avienda stared at the rolling breakers and pounding waves in amazement, then frowned at him as it hit home. She might never have seen an ocean, but she had seen maps. In her skirts, the snow gave her even more trouble than it did him, and he floundered, digging his way through as much as walking, sometimes sinking to his waist. She gasped as he scooped her up in his arms and her green eyes glared. "We have to move faster than you can dragging those skirts," he told her. The glare faded, but she did not put an arm around his neck as he had half hoped. Instead, she folded her hands and put on a patient face. A bit touched with sullenness. Whatever changes what they had done might have wrought in her, she was not completely different. He could not understand why that should be a relief. He could have melted a path through the snow as he had in the storm, but if another of those flying things came, that cleared path would lead straight to them. A fox trotted by across the snow well to his right, pure white except for a black tip to its bushy tail, occasionally eyeing him and Avienda warily. Rabbit tracks marred the snow in places, blurred where they had leapt, and once he saw the prints of a cat that had to be as large as a leopard. Maybe there were larger animals still. Maybe some flightless relative of that leathery creature. Not something he wanted to encounter, but there was always the chance the flyers might take the plowed furrow he was leaving now as the track of some animal. He still made his way from tree to tree, wishing there were more of them, and closer together. Of course, if there had been, he might not have found Avienda in the storm. She grunted, frowning up at him, and he loosened his hold on her again. But it would surely have helped now. It was because he was creeping in that way, though, that he saw the others first.
Less than 50 paces away, between him and the gateway, right at the gateway, he could feel his weave holding it, were four people on horseback and more than 20 afoot. The mounted were all women shrouded in long, thick, fur-lined cloaks. Two of them each wore a silvery bracelet on her left wrist, connected by a long leash of the same shining stuff, to a bright collar tied around the neck of a gray-clad, cloakless woman standing in the snow. The others afoot were men in dark leather and armor painted green and gold, overlapping plates down their chests and the outsides of their arms and fronts of their thighs. Their spears bore green and gold tassels, their long shields were painted in the same colors, and their helmets seemed to be the heads of huge insects, faces peering out through the mandibles. One was clearly an officer, lacking spear or shield, but with a curved two-handed sword on his back. Silver outlined the plates of his lacquered armor, and thin green plumes, like feelers, heightened the illusion of his painted helmet. Rand knew where he and Avienda were now. He had seen armor like that before, and women collared like that. Setting her down behind something that looked a little like a wind-twisted pine, except that its trunk was smooth and gray, streaked with black, he pointed, and she nodded silently.
"The two women on leashes can channel," he whispered. "Can you block them?"
Hurriedly, he added,
"Don't embrace the source yet. They're prisoners, but they still might warn the others. And even if they don't, the women with the bracelets might be able to feel them sense you."
She looked at him oddly, but wasted no time on foolish questions, such as how he knew. They would come later, he knew.
"The women with the bracelets can channel also," she replied, just as softly. "It feels very strange, though. Weak, as if they had never practiced it. I cannot see how that can be."
Rand could. Damani were the ones who were supposed to be able to channel. If two women had somehow slipped through the Shan-Chan net to become Suldam instead, and from the little he knew of them, that would not be easy, for the Shan-Chan tested every last woman during the years that she might first show signs of channeling. They would surely never dare to betray themselves.
"Can you shield all four?"
She gave him a very smug look.
"Of course. Egwene taught me to handle several flows at once. I can block them, tie those off, and wrap them up in flows of air before they know what is happening."
That self-satisfied little smile faded.
"I am fast enough to handle them and their horses, but that leaves the rest to you, until I can bring help. If any get away, they can surely cast those spears this far, and if one of them pins you to the ground..."
For a moment she muttered under her breath, as if angry that she could not complete a sentence. Finally she looked at him, her gaze as furious as he had ever seen it.
"Egwene has told me of healing, but she knows little, and I less." What could she be angry about now?
Better to try understanding the sun than a woman, he thought wryly. Tom Marilyn had told him that, and it was simple truth.
"You take care of shielding those women," he told her. "I will do the rest. Not until I touch your arm, though."
He could tell she thought he was boasting, but he would not have to split flows, only weave one intricate flow of air that would bind arms to sides and hold horses' feet as well as human. Taking a deep breath, he grabbed hold of Sidene, touched her arm, and channeled. Shocked cries rose from the Shan-Chan. He should have thought of gags, too, but they could be through the gateway before they attracted anyone else. Holding onto the source, he seized Avienda's arm and half-dragged her through the snow, ignoring her snarls that she could walk. At least this way he broke a trail for her, and they had to hurry. The Shan-Chan quieted, staring as he and Avienda made their way around in front of them. The two women, who were not Suldam, had thrown back their hoods, struggling against his weave. He held it rather than tying. He would have to release it when he went away anyway, for the simple reason that he could not leave even Shan-Chan bound in the snow. If they did not freeze to death, there was always the big cat whose tracks he had seen. Where there was one, there must be more. The gateway was there all right, but instead of looking into his room in Ironrod, it was a gray blank. It seemed narrower than he remembered, too. Worse, he could see the weave of that grayness. It had been woven from Sidene. Furious thought slid across the void. He could not tell what it was meant to do, yet it could easily be a trap for whoever stepped through, woven by one of the male Forsaken. By Asmodian, most likely. If the man could hand him over to the others, he might be able to regain his place among them. Yet there could be no question of staying here. If Avienda only remembered how she had woven the gateway in the first place, she could open another, but as it was, they were going to have to use this, trap or no. One of the mounted women, a black raven in front of a stark tower on the gray breast of her cloak, had a severe face and dark eyes that seemed to want to drill into his skull. Another, younger and paler and shorter, yet more regal, wore a silver stag's head on her green cloak. The little fingers of her riding gloves were too long. Rand knew from the shaven sides of her scalp that those long fingers covered nails grown long, and no doubt lacquered, both signs of Shanchen nobility. The soldiers were stiff-faced and stiff-backed, but the officer's blue eyes glittered behind the jaws of the insect-like helmet, and his gauntleted fingers writhed as he struggled futilely to reach his sword. Rand did not care very much about them, but he did not want to leave the Damani behind. At the least, he could give them a chance to escape. They might be staring at him as they would a wild animal with bared fangs, but they had not chosen to be prisoners, treated little better than domestic animals themselves. He put a hand to the collar of the nearest and felt a jolt that nearly numbed his arm. For an instant, the void shifted, and Sidene raged through him like the snowstorm a thousandfold. The Damani's short yellow hair flailed as she convulsed at his touch, screaming, and the Suldam connected to her gasped, face going white. Both would have fallen if not held by bonds of air. "You try it," he told Avienda, working his hand. "A woman must be able to touch the thing safely. I don't know how it unfastens." It looked of a piece, linked somehow, just like bracelet and leash. "But it went on, so it must be able to come off." A few moments could not make any difference to whatever had happened to the gateway. Was it Asmodian? Avienda shook her head, but began fumbling at the other woman's collar. "Hold still," she growled as the Damani, a pale-faced girl of 16 or 17, tried to flinch back. If the leashed woman had looked on Rand as a wild beast, they stared at Avienda like a nightmare made flesh.
"She is Marath Damani," the pale girl wailed. "Save Sari, mistress! Please, mistress, save Sari!"
The other Damani, older, almost motherly, began weeping uncontrollably. Avienda glared at Rand as hard as she did the girl for some reason, muttering angrily under her breath as she worked at the collar.
"It is he, Lady Morsa,"
the other Damani Suldam said suddenly in a soft drawl that Rand could barely understand.
"I have borne the bracelet long, and I could tell if the Marath Damani had done more than block Jinni."
Morsa did not look surprised. In fact, there seemed to be a light of horrified recognition in her blue eyes as she gazed at Rand. There was only one way that could be. "You were at Falma," he said. If he went through first, it meant leaving Avienda behind, although only for a moment.
"I was..."
The noblewoman looked faint, but her slow, slurring voice was coolly imperious.
"I saw you, and what you did."
"Take care I don't do the same here. Give me no trouble, and I will leave you in peace." He could not send Avienda first, into the light knew what. If emotion had not been so distant, he would have grimaced the way she was grimacing over that collar. They had to go through together, and be ready to face anything.
"Much has been kept secret about what happened in the lands of the great Hawkwing, Lady Morsa," the severe-faced woman said.
Her dark eyes were as hard on Morsa as they had been on him.
"Rumors fly that the ever-victorious army has tasted defeat. Do you seek truth in rumor, Jalandin?" Morsa asked in a cutting tone. "A seeker above all should know when to keep silent." The Empress herself has forbidden speech of the Carina until she calls it again. If you or I speak so much as the name of the city where that expedition landed, our tongues will be removed. Perhaps you would enjoy being tongueless in the Tower of Ravens? Not even the listeners would hear you scream for mercy or pay heed.
Rand understood no more than two words in three, and it was not the odd accents. He wished he had time to listen. Corina? The Return. That was what the Shanshan in Falma had called their attempt to seize the lands beyond the Arath Ocean. The lands where he lived, that they considered their birthright. The rest, Seeker, Listeners, the Tower of Ravens, were a mystery. But apparently the Return had been called off, for the time being at least. That was worth knowing. The gateway was narrower. Maybe as much as a finger-width narrower than moments before. Only his block held it open. It had tried to close as soon as Avienda released her weave, and it was still trying to. "Hurry," he told Avienda, and she gave him a look so patient it could as well have been a stone between his eyes.
"I am trying, Randolthor," she said, still working at the collar.
Tears trickled down Ceri's cheeks. A continuous low moan came from her throat, as if the Aiel woman intended to slit it.
"You nearly killed the other two, and maybe yourself. I could feel the power rushing into both of them wildly when you touched the other collar. So leave it to me, and if I can do it, I will."
Muttering a curse, she tried at the side. Rand thought about making the Suldam remove the collars. If anyone knew how the things came off, they would. But from the set frowns on their faces, he knew he would have to force them to it. If he could not kill a woman, he could not very well torture one. With a sigh, he glanced at the gray blankness filling the gateway again. The flows appeared to be woven into his. He could not slice one without the other. Passing through might trigger the trap, but cutting away the grayness, even if that act did not trip it, would allow the gateway to snap shut before they had a chance to leap through. It would have to be a blind jump into the light knew what. Morsa had listened carefully to every word he and Avienda said, and now she was gazing thoughtfully at the two Suldam. But Jalandin had never taken her eyes from the noblewoman's face.
"Much has been kept secret that should not be held from the Seekers, Lady Morsa," the stern woman said. "The Seekers must know all." "You forget yourself, Jalandin," Morsa snapped, her gloved hands jerking.
Had her arms not been bound to her sides, she would have sawed the reins. As it was, she tilted her head to stare down her nose at the other woman.
"You were sent to me because Sarak looks above himself and has designs on Sarangadadai and Tuol, not to ask of what the Empress has—"
Jalandin broke in harshly.
"It is you who forgets herself, Lady Morsa, if you think that you are proof against the Seekers for truth. I myself have put both a daughter and a son of the Empress, may the light bless her, to the question, and in gratitude for the confessions I wrenched from them, she allowed me to gaze upon her. Think you that your minor house stands higher than the Empress's own children?"
Morsa remained upright, not that she had much choice, but her face went gray and she licked her lips.
"The Empress, may the light illumine her forever, already knows far more than I can tell. I did not mean to imply—"
The Seeker cut her off again, twisting her head to speak to the soldiers as if Morsa did not exist.
"The woman Morsa is in the custody of the Seekers for truth. She will be put to the question as soon as we return to Merinlo. And the Suldam and Amani as well. It seems they too have hidden what they should not."
Horror painted the faces of the named women, but Morsa could have stood for any of them. Eyes wide and suddenly haggard, she slumped as much as her invisible bonds would allow, voicing not a word of protest. She looked as if she had wanted to scream, yet she accepted. Jalandin's gaze turned to Rand.
"She named you Randolthor. You will be well treated if you surrender to me, Randolthor. However you came here, you cannot think to escape, even if you kill us. There is a wide search for a Marath Damani who channeled in the night.
Her eyes flickered to Avienda.
It will find you as well, inevitably, and you might be slain by accident. There is sedition in this district. I do not know how men like you are treated in your lands, but in Shonshan your sufferings can be eased. Here you can find great honor in the use of your power.
He laughed at her, and she looked offended.
I cannot kill you, but I vow I should stripe your hide at least for that.
He certainly would not have to worry about being gentled in Shonshan hands. In Shonshan, men who could channel were killed, not executed, hunted and shot down on sight. The gray-filled gateway was another finger narrower, barely wide enough now for both of them to pass through together.
Leave her, Avienda. We have to go now.
She released Ceri's collar and gave him an exasperated look, but her eyes went past him to the gateway, and she hoisted her skirts to stump through the snow to him, muttering to herself about frozen water.
Be ready for anything, he told her, putting an arm around her shoulders.
He told himself they had to be close together to fit, not because she felt good.
I don't know what, but be ready.
She nodded, and he said,
Jump!
Together they leaped into the grayness, Rand releasing the weave that had held the Shonshan in order to fill himself to bursting with Sidene. And landed, stumbling in his bedchamber in Ironrod, lamplit with darkness outside the windows. Osmodian sat against the wall beside the door with his legs crossed. He was not embracing the source, but Rand slammed a block between the man and Sidene anyway. Whirling with his arm still around Avienda, he found the gateway gone. No, not gone. He could still see his weaving, and what he knew must be Osmodian's. But there seemed to be nothing there at all. Without pause, he slashed his weave, and suddenly the gateway appeared. A rapidly narrowing view of Shonshan, the Lady Morsa slumped in her saddle, Jelandin shouting orders. A green and white tasseled spear lanced through the opening just before it snapped shut. Instinctively, Rand channeled air to snatch the suddenly wobbling 2-foot length of spear. The shaft ended as smoothly as any craftsman could have worked it. Shivering, he was glad that he had not tried removing the gray barrier, whatever it had been, before jumping through. A good thing neither of the Suldam recovered in time, he said, taking the severed spear in his hand. Or we'd have had worse than this coming after us. He watched Osmodian from the corner of his eye, but the man only sat there, looking slightly ill. He could not know whether Rand meant to stuff that spear down his throat. Avienda's sniff was her most pointed yet.
Do you think I released them? She said heatedly.
She removed his arm firmly, but he did not think her temper was for him, or not for his arm anyway.
I tied their shields as tightly as I could. They are your enemies, Randall Thor. Even the ones you call Damani are faithful dogs would have killed you rather than be free. You must be hard with your enemies, not soft.
She was right, he thought, hefting the spear. He had left enemies behind that he might well have to face one day. He had to become harder. Or else he would be ground to flour before he ever reached Shael Ghul. Abruptly, she began smoothing her skirts, and her voice became almost conversational.
I noticed that you did not save that way-faced Morsa from her fate. From the way you looked at her, I thought big eyes and a round bosom had caught your eye.
Rand stared at her in amazement that oozed across the emptiness surrounding him like syrup. She could have been saying the soup was ready. He wondered how he was supposed to have noticed Morsa's bosom, hidden as it was in a fur-lined cloak. I should have brought her, he said, to question her about the Shonshan. I will be troubled by them again, I am afraid. The glint that had appeared in her eye vanished. She opened her mouth, but stopped, glancing at Osmodian, when he raised a hand. He could all but see the questions about Shonshan piled up behind her eyes. If he knew her, once begun, she would not stop digging until she had uncovered scraps he did not even remember he knew. Which might not be a bad thing. Another time. After he had wrung a few answers out of Osmodian. She was right. He had to be hard.
"That was a smart thing you did," she said, "hiding the hole I made. If a guy Shine had come in here, 1,000 of the Spear Sisters might have marched through seeking you."
Asmodian cleared his throat.
"One of the guy Shine did come. Someone named Sulin had told her she must see you eat, my Lord Dragon. And to stop her from bringing the tray in here and finding you gone, I took the liberty of telling her that you and the young woman did not want to be disturbed."
A slight tightening of his eyes caught Rand's attention.
"What?" "Just that she took it strangely. She laughed out loud and went running off. A few minutes later, there must have been 20 Fardarai's Mai beneath the window, shouting and beating their spears and their bucklers for a good hour or more. I must say, my Lord Dragon, some of the suggestions they called up startled even me."
Rand felt his cheeks burning. It had happened on the other side of the bloody world, and still the maidens knew. But Avienda only narrowed her eyes.
"Did she have hair and eyes like mine?"
She did not wait for Asmodian's nod.
"It must have been my first sister, Niella."
She saw the startled question on Rand's face and answered it before he could speak.
"Niella is a weaver, not a maiden, and she was taken half a year ago by Charine maidens during a raid on Sulara Hold. She tried to talk me out of taking the spear, and she has always wanted me wed. I'm going to send her back to the Charine with a welt on her bottom for everyone she told."
Rand caught her arm as she started to stalk out of the room. "I want to talk with Natale. I don't suppose there is much time left until dawn."
2 hours, maybe," Asmodian put in. "So there will be little sleeping now. If you want to try, would you mind making your bed elsewhere for what's left of the night? You need new blankets anyway."
She nodded curtly before pulling loose and slammed the door behind her. Surely she was not angry at being tossed out of his bedchamber. How could she be? She had said nothing more would happen between them. But he was glad he was not Niella. Bouncing the shortened spear in his hand, he turned to Asmodian.
"A strange scepter, my Lord Dragon."
"It will do for one." To remind him that the Seanchan were still out there. For once he wished his voice was even colder than the void in Saidin made it. He had to be hard.
"Before I decide whether to skewer you with it like a lamb, why did you never mention this trick of making something invisible? If I hadn't been able to see the flows, I'd never have known the gateway was still there."
Asmodian swallowed, shifting as though he did not know whether Rand meant his threat. Rand was not sure himself.
"My Lord Dragon, you never asked. A matter of bending light. You always have so many questions, it is hard to find a moment to speak of anything else. You must realize by now that I have thrown my lot in with yours completely."
Licking his lips, he got up, as far as his knees, and began to babble.
"I felt your weave. Anybody within a mile could have felt it. I never saw anything like it. I didn't know that anyone but Demondred could block a gateway that was closing, and maybe Simmerhug, and Lutheran. I felt it, and came, and a hard time I had getting past those maidens. I used the same trick. You must know I am your man now. My Lord Dragon, I am your man."
It was the repetition of what the Cariennan had said that got through as much as anything else. Gesturing with the half-spear, he said roughly,
"Stand. You want a dog."
But as Asmodian slowly rose, he laid the long spear point alongside the man's throat. He had to be hard.
"From now on, you will tell me 2 things I don't ask about every time we talk. Every time, mind. If I think you are trying to hide anything from me, you will be glad to let Simmerhug have you." "As you say, my Lord Dragon," Asmodian stammered.
He looked ready to bow and kiss Rand's hand. To avoid the chance, Rand moved to the blanketless bed and sat on the linen sheet, the feather mattresses yielding under him as he studied the spear. A good idea to keep it for remembrance, if not as a scepter. Even with everything else, he had best not forget the Seanchan. Those Demani. If Avienda had not been there to block them from the source...
"You have tried showing me how to shield a woman and failed. try showing me how to avoid flows I cannot see, how to counter them.
Once Lanfear had sliced his weavings as neatly as with a knife.
Not easy, my lord dragon, without a woman to practice against.
We have 2 hours, Rand said coldly, letting the man's shield unravel.
Try. Try very hard.
Chapter 33 A Question of Crimson. The knife brushed Nynaeve's hair as it thunked into the board she was leaning against, and she flinched behind her blindfold. She wished she had a decent braid instead of locks hanging loose about her shoulders. If that blade had cut even one strand... Fool woman, she thought bitterly. Fool, fool woman. With the scarf folded over her eyes, she could just see a narrow line of light at the bottom. It seemed bright from the darkness behind the thick folds. There had to be enough light yet, even if it was late afternoon. Surely the man would not throw when he could not see properly. The next blade struck on the other side of her head. She could feel it vibrating. She thought it almost touched her ear. She was going to kill Tom Marilyn and Valen Luca, and maybe any other man she could get her hands on sheer principle. "The pears!" Luca shouted, as if he were not just 30 paces from her. He must think the blindfold made her deaf as well as blind. Fumbling in the pouch at her belt, she brought out a pear and carefully balanced it atop her head. She was blind, a pure blind fool. 2 more pears, and she gingerly extended her arms to either side between the knives that outlined her, holding one in either hand by the stems. There was a pause. She opened her mouth to tell Tom Marilyn that if he so much as nicked her, she would... Chunk, chunk, chunk! The blades came so fast, she would have yelped if her throat had not contracted like a fist. She held only the stem in her left hand. The other pear trembled faintly with the knife through it, and the pear on her head leaked juice into her hair. Snatching the scarf off, she stalked toward Tom and Luca, both of them grinning like maniacs. Before she could speak one of the words boiling up in her, Luca said admiringly, "You are magnificent, Nana. Your bravery is magnificent, but you are more so." He swirled that ridiculous red silk cloak in a bow, one hand over his heart. "I shall call this Rose Among Thorns, though truly you are more beautiful than any mere rose." "It doesn't take much bravery to stand like a stump." A rose, was she? She would show him thorns. She would show both of them. "You listen to me, Valen Luca. Such courage. You never even flinch. I tell you, I would not have the stomach to do what you are doing." That was the simple truth, she told herself. "I am no braver than I have to be," she said in a milder tone. It was hard to shout at a man who insisted on telling you how brave you were. Certainly better to hear than all that blather about roses. Tom knuckled his long white mustaches as if he saw something funny. "The dress," Luca said, showing all of his teeth in a smile. "You will look wonderful in..." "No!" she snapped. Whatever he had gained, he had just lost by bringing this up again. Clarine had made the dress Luca wanted her to wear, in silk more crimson than his cloak. It was her opinion that the color was to hide blood if Tom's hand slipped. "But, Nana, beauty in danger is a great draw," Luca's voice crooned, as if whispering sweetness in her ear. "You will have every eye on you, every heart pounding for your beauty and courage." "If you like it so much," she said firmly, "you wear it." Aside from the color, she was not about to show that much bosom in public, whether or not Clarine thought it was proper. She had seen Latelle's performing dress, all black spangles with a high neck to her chin. She could wear something like... What was she thinking? She had no intention of actually going through with this. She'd only agreed to this practice to stop Luca scratching at the wagon door every night to try convincing her. The man was nothing if not deft at knowing when to change the subject. "What happened here?" he asked, suddenly all smooth solicitude. She flinched as he touched her puffy eye. It was his bad luck to choose that. He would have done better to continue trying to stuff her into that red dress. I did not like the way it looked at me in the mirror this morning, so I bit it. Her flat tone and bared teeth made Luca snatch his hand back. From the wary gleam in his dark eyes, he suspected she might bite again. Tom was stroking his mustaches furiously, red in the face from the effort of not laughing. He knew what had happened, of course. He would. And as soon as she left, he would no doubt regale Luca with his version of events. Men could not avoid gossiping. It was in them at birth, and nothing women could do ever got it out of them. The daylight was dimmer than she had thought. The sun sat red on the treetops to the west. "If you ever try this again without better light," she growled, shaking a fist at Tom. "It's almost dusk." "I suppose," the man said, bushy eyebrow lifting, "this means you want to leave out the bit where I am blindfolded?" He was joking, of course. He had to be joking. "As you wish, Nana. From now on, only in the most perfect light." It was not until she stalked away, swishing her skirts angrily, that she realized that she had agreed to actually do this fool thing, by implication at least. They would try to hold her to it as surely as the sun would set tonight. Fool, fool, fool woman. The clearing where they, or Tom at least, burn him and Luca both, had been practicing stood some little distance from the camp over beside the road north. Doubtless Luca had not wanted to upset the animals should Tom put one of his knives through her heart. The man would likely have fed her corpse to the lions. The only reason he wanted her to wear that dress was so he could ogle what she had no intention of showing to anyone but Lan, and burn him too for a stubborn fool man. She wished she had him there so she could tell him so. She wished she had him there so she could be sure he was safe. She broke a dead dog fennel and used its feathery brown length like a whip to snap the heads off weeds that poked through the leaves on the ground. Last night, Elaine had said, Egwene reported fighting in Kyrian, skirmishes with brigands, and Kyrianan who saw any Aiel as an enemy, with Andoran soldiers trying to claim the Sun Throne for Morghaes. Lan had been involved in them. Whenever Moiraine let him out of her sight, he apparently managed to take himself to the fighting, as if he could sense where it would be. Nynaeve had never thought that she would want the Aes Sedai to keep Lan on a short leash at her side. This morning Elaine had still been disturbed about her mother's soldiers being in Kyrian, fighting Rand's Aiel, but what worried Nynaeve was the brigands. According to Egwene, if anyone could identify stolen property in a brigand's possession, if anyone could swear to seeing him kill anyone or burn so much as a shed, Rand was hanging him. He did not put his hands on the rope, but it was the same thing, and Egwene said he watched every execution with a face cold and hard as the mountains. That was not like him. He had been a gentle boy. Whatever had happened to him in the waste had been very much for the worse. Well, Rand was far away, and her own problems, hers and Elaine's, were no nearer solution. The river Eldar lay less than a mile north, spanned by a single lofty stone bridge built between tall metal pillars that glistened without a speck of rust. Remnants of an earlier time, certainly, perhaps even an earlier age. She had gone up to it at midday, right after they arrived, but there had not been a boat in the river worthy of the name. Rowboats, small fishing boats working along the reed-lined banks, some strange, narrow little things that skittered over the water propelled by kneeling men with paddles, even a squat barge that looked to be moored in mud. There seemed to be a lot of mud showing on both sides, some of it dried hard and cracked, yet that was no wonder with the heat holding on so unseasonably. But nothing that could carry them swiftly away downriver as she wanted. Not that she knew where it was to take them yet. Rack her brains as she would, she could not remember the name of the town where the Blue Sisters were supposed to be. She swiped savagely at a scatterhead, and it burst in little white feathers that floated to the ground. They probably were not there any more in any case, if they ever had been. But it was the only clue they had to a safe place short of Tyr, if she could only remember it. The only good thing on the entire journey north was that Elaine had stopped flirting with Tom. There had not been an incident since joining the show. At least it would have been good if Elaine had not apparently decided to pretend nothing had ever happened. Yesterday Nynaeve had congratulated the girl on coming to her senses, and Elaine had coolly replied, "Are you trying to find out if I will stand in your way with Tom, Nynaeve? He's rather old for you, and I did think you had planted your affections elsewhere, but you are old enough to make your own decisions. I am fond of Tom, as I think he is of me. I look on him like a second father. If you want to flirt with him, you have my permission, but I really did think you were more constant." Luca meant to cross the river in the morning, and Samara, the town on the other side in Gildan, was no fit place to be. Luca had spent most of the day since their arrival over in Samara securing a place to set up his show. He was only concerned that a number of other menageries had beaten him there, and he was not the only one to have more than animals. That was why he had grown particularly insistent about her letting Tom throw knives at her. She was lucky he did not want it done high-walking with Elaine. The man seemed to think the most important thing in the world was that his show should be bigger and better than any other. For herself, the worrisome thing was that the prophet was in Samara, his followers crowding the town and spilling out into tents, huts, and shanties around it, a city that overwhelmed Samara's own not inconsiderable size. It had a high stone wall, and most of the buildings were stone as well, many as much as three stories, and there were more roofs of slate or tile than thatch. This side of the Eldar was no better. They had passed three white cloak encampments before reaching their stopping place, hundreds of white tents in neat rows, and there had to be more they had not seen. White cloaks on this side of the river, the prophet, and maybe a riot waiting to happen on the other, and she had no idea where to go and no way to get there except in a lumbering wagon that moved no faster than she could walk. She wished she had never let Elaine talk her into abandoning the coach. Not seeing a weed close enough to snap without stepping aside, she broke the dog fennel in half, then again, until the pieces were no longer than her hand, and tossed them to the ground. She wished she could do the same with Luca, and Galad Damodred for sending them running here, and Aulan Mandragoran for not being here. Not that she needed him, of course, but his presence would have been a comfort. The camp was quiet, with evening meals cooking over small fires beside the wagons. Petra was feeding the black-maned lion, thrusting huge pieces of meat through the bars on a stick. The female lions were already hunkered down over theirs companionably, letting out an occasional growl if someone came too close to their cage. Nynaeve stopped near Aludra's wagon. The illuminator was working with wooden mortar and pestle on a table let down from the side of her wagon, muttering to herself over what she was compounding. Three of the Chavanas smiled at Nynaeve enticingly, motioning her to join them. Not Brug, who still glowered over his lip, though she had given him a salve to make the swelling go down. Maybe if she hit the rest of them as hard, they would listen to Luca, and more importantly to her, and realize that she did not want their smiles. Too bad Master Valen Luca could not follow his own instructions. Latel turned from the bear cage and gave her a tight smile, more of a smirk, really. Mainly, though, Nynaeve stared at Sarandon, who was filing the blunt toenails of one of the huge gray sredit with what looked like a tool suitable for metal. "That one," Aludra said. "She uses the hands and the feet with remarkable ability, no? Do not glare at me so, Nana," she added, dusting her hands. "I am not your enemy. Here, you must try these new fire sticks." Nynaeve took the wooden box from the dark-haired woman gingerly. It was a cube she could have held easily with one hand, but she used both. "I thought you called them strikers." "Maybe yes, maybe no. Fire sticks, it says what they are much better than strikers, yes? I have smoothed the little holes that hold the sticks, so they can no longer ignite on the wood. A good idea, no? And the heads, they are a new formulation. You will try them and tell me what you think? Yes, of course. Thank you. Nynaeve hurried on before the woman could press another box on her. She held the thing as if it might explode, which she was not certain it would not. Aludra had everyone trying out her strikers or fire sticks or whatever she would decide to call them next. They certainly would light a fire or a lamp. They could also burst into flame if the blue-gray heads rubbed against each other or anything else rough. For herself, she would stick with flint and steel, or a coal kept properly banked in a box of sand. Much safer. Julin caught her before she could set foot on the steps of the wagon she shared with Elaine, his gaze going straight to her swollen eye. She glared at him so hard that he stepped back and snatched that ridiculous conical cap from his head. "I've been over the river," he said. "There are 100 or so white cloaks in Samara, just watching and being watched as hard themselves by Gil'danin soldiers. But I recognized one, the young fellow who was sitting across from the Light of Truth in Sienda." She smiled at him, and he took another hasty step back, eyeing her warily. Galad in Samara. That was all they needed. "You always bring such wonderful news, Julin. We should have left you in Tanchico, or better, on the dock in Tyr." That was hardly fair. Better he told her of Galad than that she walked around a corner into the man. "Thank you, Julin. At least we know to keep an eye out for him now." His nod was hardly a proper response to graciously offered thanks, and he hurried away, clapping his hat on, as if he expected her to hit him. Men had no manners. The interior of the wagon was far cleaner than it had been when Tom and Julin purchased it. The flaking paint had all been scraped off, the men had grumbled about doing that, and the cabinets and the tiny table that was fastened to the floor oiled until they shone. The small brick stove with its metal chimney was never used. The nights were warm enough, and if they began cooking in here, Tom and Julin would never take another turn. But it made a good place to keep their valuables, the purses and the jewelry boxes. The wash leather pouch holding the seal, that she had stuffed in as far as it would go and had not touched since. Elaine, seated on one of the narrow beds, stuffed something under the blankets when Nynaeve climbed inside, but before she could ask what it was, Elaine exclaimed, "Your eye! What happened to you?" They needed to wash her hair in hen pepper again. Faint hints of gold were showing at the roots of those black tresses. It had to be done every few days. "Sarandon hit me when I wasn't looking," Nynaeve muttered. The remembered taste of boiled catfern and powdered maven's leaf made her tongue curl. That was not why she had let Elaine go to the last meeting in Tel Iron Riad, too. She was not avoiding Egwene. It was just that she made most of the journeys into the world of dreams between meetings, and it was only fair to give Elaine her chances to go. That was it. Carefully, she put the box of fire sticks into one of the cabinets, next to two more. The one that had actually caught fire was long since discarded. She did not know why she was hiding the truth. Elaine had obviously not been outside the wagon, or she would know already. She and Julin were probably the only people in camp who did not know, now that Tom had surely revealed every disgusting detail to Luca. Taking a deep breath, she sat down on the other bed and made herself meet Elaine's eyes. Something in the quiet of the other woman said she knew that more was coming. "I asked Sarandon about Damani and Suldam. I'm certain she knows more than she lets on." She paused for Elaine to voice doubt that she had asked rather than demanded, to say that the Shan Chan woman had already told them all she knew, that she had not had much contact with Damani or Suldam. But Elaine kept silent, and Nynaeve realized that she was only hoping to postpone the moment with an argument. She got quite heated about not knowing any more, so I shook her. "You've really gone too far with her. She waggled her finger under my nose." Still, Elaine only watched her, those cool blue eyes barely blinking. It was all Nynaeve could do not to look away as she went on. "She threw me, somehow, over her shoulder. I got up and slapped her, and she knocked me down with her fist. That is how I got the eye. She might as well tell the rest. Elaine would hear soon enough. Better it came from her. She would rather have pulled out her tongue. I wasn't about to put up with that, certainly. We scuffled a little more. Not much of a scuffle on her part, for all that she had refused to quit. The bitterest truth was that Sarandon had only stopped flipping her about and tripping her in sneaky ways because it had been like manhandling a child. Nynaeve had had as much chance as that child. If only no one had been watching, so she could have channeled. She had certainly been angry enough. If only no one had been watching, period. She wished Sarandon had pounded her with her fists until she bled. Then Latell gave her a stick. You know how that woman wants to get back at me. There was certainly no need to say that Sarandon had been holding her head down over a wagon tongue at the time. No one had manhandled her like that since she threw a pitcher of water at Nyssa Aiellyn when she was 16. Anyway, Petra broke it up. Just in time, too. The huge man had taken the pair of them by the scruff of the neck like kittens. Sarandon apologized, and that was that. Petra had made the Shan-Chan woman apologize, true, but he had made Nynaeve do so as well, refusing to loose that gentle yet iron-hard grip on her neck until she did. She had hit him as hard as she could, right in the stomach, and he had not even blinked. Her hand felt as if it might swell, too. Nothing much to it, really. I suppose Latell will try to spread some story of her own making about it. That is the woman I ought to shake. I didn't hit her half hard enough. She felt better for telling the truth, but Elaine had doubt on her face that made her want to change the subject. What is that you're hiding? She reached over and pulled the blanket back, revealing the silvery length of the eidom they had gotten from Sarandon. Why under the light do you want to look at that? And if you do, why hide it? It is a filthy thing, and I cannot understand how you can touch it, but if you want to, that is entirely up to you. Don't sound so prim, Elaine told her. A slow smile broke across her face, a flush of excitement. I think I could make one. Make one? Nynaeve lowered her voice, hoping no one came running to see who was killing whom, but she did not soften it any. Light, why? Make an open cesspit first. A midden heap. At least there's some decent use for those. I do not mean to actually make an eidom. Elaine held herself erect, chin tilted in that cool way of hers. She sounded offended and icily calm. But it is a Tarangrial, and I have puzzled out how it works. I saw you attend at least one lecture on linking. The eidom links the two women. That is why the Suldam must be a woman who can channel, too. She frowned slightly. It is a strange link, though. Different. Instead of two or more sharing, with one guiding, it is one taking full control, really. I think that is the reason a Damani cannot do anything the Suldam doesn't want her to. I don't really believe there is any need for the leash. The collar and bracelet would work as well without it, and in just the same ways. Work as well, Nynaeve said dryly. You've studied the matter a great deal for someone who has no intention of making one. The woman did not even have the grace to blush. What use would you put it to? I cannot say I would take it amiss if you put one around Elida's neck, but that doesn't make it any less disgust. Don't you understand? Elaine broke in, haughtiness all gone in excitement and fervor. She leaned forward to put a hand on Nynaeve's knee, and her eyes shone, she was so delighted with herself. It is a Tarangrial, Nynaeve, and I think I can make one. She said each word slowly and deliberately, then laughed and rushed on. If I can make this one, I can make others. Maybe I can even make Angrial and Saangrial. No one in the tower has been able to do that in thousands of years. Straightening, she shivered, and laid fingers across her mouth. I never really thought of making anything myself before. Not anything useful. I remember seeing a craftsman once, a man who had made some chairs for the palace. They were not gilded or elaborately carved. They were meant for the servants' hall, but I could see the pride in his eyes. Pride in what he had made, a thing well crafted. I would love to feel that, I think. Oh, if we only knew a fraction of what the Forsaken do. The knowledge of the Age of Legends inside their heads, and they use it to serve the Shadow. Think what we could do with it. Think what we could make. She took a deep breath, dropping her hands in her lap, her enthusiasm barely diminished. Well, be that as it may, I'll wager I could puzzle out how Whitebridge was made, too. Buildings like spun glass but stronger than steel, and Quendilar and... Slow down, Nynaeve said. Whitebridge is 500 or 600 miles from here at least, and if you think you're going to go channeling at the seal, you can think again. Who knows what could happen? It stays in its pouch in the stove until we find somewhere safe for it. Elaine's eagerness was very odd. Nynaeve would not have minded a little of the Forsaken's knowledge herself, far from it. But if she wanted a chair, she paid a carpenter. She'd never wanted to make anything aside from poultices and salves. When she was 12, her mother had stopped going through the motions of teaching her to sew after it became apparent that she did not care whether she sewed a straight seam, and could not be made to care. As for cooking, she thought she was a good cook, actually, but the point was that she knew what was significant. Healing was important. Any man could build a bridge, and leave him to it, was what she said. With you and your Idom, she went on, I nearly forgot to tell you. Juelin saw Galad on the other side of the river. Blood and bloody ashes, Elaine muttered, and when Nynaeve raised her eyebrows, she added very firmly, I will not listen to a lecture on my language, Nynaeve. What are we going to do? As I see it, we can remain on this side of the river and have white cloaks looking us over, wondering why we left the menagerie, or we can cross the bridge and hope the prophet doesn't spark a riot, and Galad doesn't denounce us, or we can try to buy a rowboat and flee downriver. Not very good choices. And Luca will want his 100 marks. Gold. She tried not to scowl, but that still rankled. You promised it to him, and I suppose it would not be honest to sneak away without paying him. She would have done it in a minute if there was anywhere to go. It certainly would not be, Elaine said, sounding shocked. But we do not have to worry about Galad, at least not as long as we stay close to the menagerie. Galad won't go near one. He thinks putting animals in cages is cruel. He doesn't mind hunting them, mind, or eating them, only caging them. Nynaeve shook her head. The truth was that Elaine would have found some way to delay, if only for one day, had there been any way to leave. The woman really wanted to highwalk in front of people other than the rest of the performers, and she herself was probably going to have to let Tom throw knives at her again. I am not wearing that bloody dress, though. The first boat that comes large enough to take 4 people, she said. We are hiring it. Trade on the river can't have stopped altogether. It would help if we knew where we were going. The other woman's tone was much too gentle. We could simply head for Tyr, you know. We do not have to stay fixed to this just because you... She trailed off, but Nynaeve knew what she'd been going to say. Just because she was stubborn. Just because she was so furious that she could not remember a simple name that she intended to remember it and go there if it killed her. Well, none of that was true. She intended to find these Aes Sedai who might just support Rand and bring them to him, not trail into Tyr like a pitiful refugee fleeing for safety. I will remember, she said in a level tone. It ended with bar. Or was it dar? Lar? Before you are tired of flaunting yourself high-walking, I will. I will not wear that dress. Chapter 34 A Silver Arrow Elaine had the cooking that evening, which meant that none of the food was simple, despite the fact that they were eating on stools around a cook fire with crickets chirping in the surrounding woods, and now and again some night bird's thin, sad cry in the deepening darkness. The soup was served cold and jellied, with chopped green ferris sprinkled on top. The light knew where she had found ferris, or the tiny onions she put in with the peas. The beef was sliced nearly thin enough to see through, and wrapped around something made from carrots, sweet beans, chives, and goat cheese, and there was even a small honey cake for dessert. It was all tasty, though Elaine fretted that nothing was exactly the way it should be, as if she thought she could duplicate the cook's work in the royal palace in Camelin. Nynaeve was fairly sure the girl was not fishing for compliments. Elaine would always brush away compliments and tell you exactly what was not right. Tom and Julin grumbled about there being so little beef, but Nynaeve noticed that they not only ate every scrap, but looked disappointed when the last pea was gone. When she cooked, for some reason they always seemed to eat at one of the other wagons. When one of them made supper, it was always stew, or else meat and beans so full of dried peppers that your tongue blistered. They did not eat alone, of course. Luca saw to that, bringing his own stool and placing it right next to her, his red cloak spread to best effect, and his long legs stretched out so that his calves showed well above his turned-down boots. He was there almost every night. Oddly, the only nights he missed were when she cooked. It was interesting, really, having his eyes on her when a woman as pretty as Elaine was there, but he did have his motives. He sat altogether too close. Tonight she moved her stool 3 times, but he followed without missing a word or seeming to notice, and he alternated comparing her with various flowers, to the blossom's detriment, ignoring the black eye he could not miss without being blind, and musing over how beautiful she would be in that red dress, with compliments on her courage thrown in. Twice he slipped in suggestions that they take a stroll by moonlight, hints so veiled that she was not entirely sure that was what they were until she thought about it. "That gown will frame your unfolding bravery to perfection," he murmured in her ear. "Yet not a quarter so well as you display yourself, for night-blooming Dara lilies would weep with envy to see you stroll beside the moonlit water, as I would do, and make myself a bard to sing your praises by this very moon." She blinked at him, working that out. Luca seemed to believe she was fluttering her lashes. She accidentally hit him in the ribs with her elbow before he could nibble her ear. At least, that seemed to be his intention, even if he was coughing now and claiming he had swallowed a cake crumb the wrong way. The man was certainly handsome. "Stop that!" And he did have a shapely calf. "What are you doing looking at his legs? But he must think her a brainless ninny. It was all in aid of his bloody show." She moved her stool again while he was trying to get his breath back. She could not move it far without making it clear that she was running from him, though she held her fork ready in case he followed again. Tom studied his plate as though more than a smear remained on the white glaze. Julin whistled tunelessly and nearly silently, peering into the dying fire with false intensity. Elaine looked at her and shook her head. "It was so pleasant of you to join us," Nynaeve said, and stood up. Luca stood when she did, a hopeful look in his eye along with the shine of the firelight. She set her plate atop the one in his hand. "Tom and Julin will be grateful for your help with the dishes, I am sure." Before his mouth finished falling open, she turned to Elaine. "It is late, and I expect we'll be moving across the river early." "Of course," Elaine murmured, with just the hint of a smile. And she put her plate atop Nynaeve's before following her into the wagon. Nynaeve wanted to hug her, until she said, "Really? You should not encourage him." Lamps mounted in wall brackets sprang alight. Nynaeve planted her fists on her hips. "Encourage him? The only way I could encourage him less would be to stab him." Sniffing for emphasis, she frowned at the lamps. "Next time, use one of Aludra's fire sticks. Strikers. You are going to forget one day and channel where you shouldn't, and then where will we be? running for our lives with 100 white cloaks after us. Stubborn to a fault, the other woman refused to be diverted. I may be younger than you, but sometimes I think I know more of men than you ever will. For a man like Valen Luca, that coy little flight of yours tonight was only asking him to keep pursuing you. If you would snap his nose off the way you did the first day, he might give up. You don't tell him to stop. You do not even ask. You kept smiling at him, Nynaeve. What is the man supposed to think? You haven't smiled at anyone in days. I am trying to hold my temper, Nynaeve muttered. Everybody complained about her temper, and now that she was trying to control it, Elaine complained about that. It was not that she was fool enough to be taken in by his compliments. She certainly was not so big a fool as that. Elaine laughed at her, and she scowled. Oh, Nynaeve, you cannot hold the sun down at dawn. Leany could have been thinking of you. With an effort, Nynaeve smoothed her face. She could, too, hold her temper. Didn't I just prove it out there? She held out her hand. Let me have the ring. He will want to cross the river early tomorrow, and I want at least some real sleep after I'm done. I thought I would go tonight. Concern touched Elaine's voice. Nynaeve, you've been entering Telairun Riod practically every night except the meetings with Egwene. That bear intends to pick a bone with you, by the way. I had to tell them why you weren't there yet again, and she says you should not need rest however often you enter unless you're doing something wrong. Concern became firmness, and the younger woman planted her fists on her hips. I had to listen to a lecture that was meant for you, and it was not pleasant, with Egwene standing there nodding her head to every word. Now I really think that tonight I should... Please, Elaine. Nynaeve did not lower her outstretched hand. I have questions for Birgitta, and her answers might make me think of more. She did have, sort of. She could always think of questions for Birgitta. It had nothing to do with avoiding Egwene and the Wise Ones. If she visited Telairun Riod so often that Elaine always went to the meetings with Egwene, that was simply how it fell out. Elaine sighed, but fished the twisted stone ring from the neck of her dress. Ask her again, Nynaeve. It is very difficult facing Egwene. She saw Birgitta. She doesn't say anything, but she looks at me. It is worse when we meet again after the Wise Ones have gone. She could ask then, and she still doesn't, and that makes it far worse. She frowned as Nynaeve transferred the small Turangreal to the leather cord around her own neck, with Lan's heavy ring and her great serpent. Why do you suppose none of the Wise Ones ever come with her, then? We don't learn very much in Elida's study, but you would think they would at least want to see the tower. Egwene doesn't even want to talk about it in front of them. If I seem to come close, she gives me such a look that you'd think she meant to hit me. I think they want to avoid the tower as much as possible. And wise they were indeed for that. If not for healing, she would avoid it, and Aes Sedai, too. She was not becoming Aes Sedai. She was just hoping to learn more of healing, and to help Rand, certainly. They are free women, Elaine. Even if the tower was not in the mess it is, would they really want Aes Sedai traipsing through the waste, scooping them up to carry back to Tar Valon? I suppose that is it. Elaine's tone said she could not understand it, though. She thought the tower wonderful, and could not see why any woman would want to evade Aes Sedai. Sealed to the White Tower forever, they said when they put that ring on your finger, and they meant it. Yet the fool girl did not see it as onerous at all. Elaine helped her undress, and she stretched out on her narrow bed in her shift, yawning. It had been a long day, and it was surprising how tiring standing still could be when someone unseen was hurling knives at you. Idle thoughts drifted through her head as she closed her eyes. Elaine had claimed she was practicing when she had acted the fool with Tom. Not that the fond father and favorite daughter they tried on now was much less foolish to watch. Maybe she could practice herself, just a bit, with Valen. Now that was foolish. Men's eyes might wander. Lan's had better not, but she knew how to be constant. She was simply not going to wear that dress. Far too much bosom. Vaguely she heard Elaine say, "Remember to ask her again." Sleep took her. She stood outside the wagon in the night. The moon was high, and drifting clouds cast shadows over the camp. Crickets chirruped, and the nightbirds called. The lion's eyes shone as they watched her from their cages. The white-faced bears were dark sleeping mounds behind the iron bars. The long picket line stood empty of horses. Clarine's dogs were not on their leashes beneath her and Petra's wagon, and the space where the Sredit stood in the waking world was bare. She had come to understand that only wild creatures had reflections here, but whatever the Shan-Chan woman claimed, it was hard to think that those huge gray animals had been domesticated so long that they were no longer wild. Abruptly she realized that she was wearing the dress, blazing red, far too snug around the hips for decency, and a square neck cut so low she thought she might pop out. She could not imagine any woman but Berylaine donning it. For Lan, she might, if they were alone. She had been thinking of Lan when she drifted off. I was, wasn't I? In any case, she was not about to let Brigitta see her in the thing. The woman claimed to be a soldier, and the more time Nynaeve spent with her, the more she realized that some of her attitudes and comments were as bad as any man's. Worse, a combination of Berylaine and a tavern brawler. The comments did not come out all the time, but they certainly did whenever Nynaeve allowed idle thoughts to put her in anything like this dress. She changed to good, stout Two Rivers wool, dark, with a plain shawl she did not need, her hair decently braided again, and opened her mouth to call Brigitta. "Why did you change?" the woman said, stepping out from the shadows to lean on her silver bow. Her intricate golden braid hung over her shoulder, and moonlight shone on her bow and arrows. "I remember wearing a gown that could have been twin to that once. It was only to attract attention so Gadol could sneak by. The guard's eyes bulged like frogs, but it was fun, especially when I wore it dancing with him later." He always hates dancing, but he was so intent on keeping any other man from getting close that he danced every dance. Brigitta laughed fondly. I won 50 gold solids from him that night at Spin, because he stared so much he never looked at his tiles. Men are peculiar. It was not as if he had never seen me. That's as may be, Nynaeve cut in primly, wrapping the shawl firmly around her shoulders. Before she could ask her question, Brigitta said, "I have found her," and all thought of the question fled. "Where? Did she see you? Can you take me to her, without her seeing?" Fear fluttered in Nynaeve's belly. A fat lot Valen Luca would say about her courage if he could see her now, but she was sure it would turn to anger as soon as she saw Mogadine. "If you can bring me close..." She trailed off as Brigitta raised a hand. "I cannot think she saw me, or I doubt I would be here now." She was all seriousness now. Nynaeve found it much easier to be around her when she showed this side of being a soldier. "I can take you close for a moment, if you want to go, but she is not alone. At least, you will see. You must be silent, and you must take no action against Mogadine. There are other Forsaken. Perhaps you could destroy her, but can you destroy five of them?" The fluttering in Nynaeve's middle spread to her chest and her knees. Five. She should ask what Brigitta had seen or heard and let it go at that. Then she could return to her bed and... But Brigitta was looking at her, not questioning her courage, only looking, ready to do this thing if she said, "I will be silent, and I won't even think of channeling, not with five Forsaken together." Not that she could have channeled a spark at that moment. She stiffened her knees to keep them from knocking. "Whenever you are ready." Brigitta hefted her bow and put a hand on Nynaeve's arm, and Nynaeve's breath caught in her throat. They were standing on nothing, infinite blackness all around, no way to tell up from down, and in every direction a fall that would last forever. Head spinning, she made herself look where Brigitta pointed. Below them, Mogadine also stood on darkness, garb nearly as black as what surrounded her, bent and listening intently. and as far below her, four huge high-backed chairs, each different, sat on an expanse of glistening white-tiled floor, floating in the blackness. Strangely, Nynaeve could hear what those in the chairs said as well as if she had been among them. "Never been a coward," a plumply pretty sun-haired woman was saying. "So why begin?" Seemingly attired in silver-gray mist and sparkling gems, she lounged in a chair of ivory worked so it appeared made of naked acrobats. Four carved men held it aloft, and her arms rested along the backs of kneeling women. Two men and two women held a white silk cushion behind her head, while above more were contorted into shapes Nynaeve did not believe a human body could attain. She blushed when she realized that some were performing more than acrobatic tricks. A compact man of middling height with a livid scar across his face and a square golden beard leaned forward angrily. His chair was heavy wood, carved with columns of armored men and horses, a steel-gauntleted fist clasping lightning at the back's peak. His red coat made up for the lack of gilding on the chair, for golden scrollwork rolled across his shoulders and down his arms.
"No one names me coward," he said harshly. "But if we continue as we are, he will come straight for my throat."
"That has been the plan from the beginning," said a woman's melodious voice. Nynaeve could not see the speaker, hidden behind the towering back of a chair that seemed all snow-white stone and silver. The second man was large and darkly handsome, with white wings streaking his temples. He toyed with an ornate golden goblet, leaning back in a throne. That was the only possible word for the gem-encrusted thing. A mere hint of gold showed here and there, but Nynaeve would not have doubted that it was solid gold beneath all those glittering rubies and emeralds and moonstones. It had an air of weight, quite apart from its massive size.
"He will concentrate on you," the big man said in a deep voice. "If need be, one close to him will die, plainly at your order. He will come for you. And while he is fixed on you alone, the three of us linked will take him. What has changed to alter any of that?"
"Nothing has changed," the scarred man growled. "Least of all my trust for you. I will be part of the link, or it ends now." The golden-haired woman threw back her head and laughed. "Poor man," she said mockingly, waving a beringed hand at him. "Do you think he would not notice that you were linked? He has a teacher, remember. A poor one, but not a complete fool. Next he will ask to include enough of those black Aja children to take the circle beyond 13, so you or Ravin must have control." "If Ravin trusts us enough to link when he must allow one of us to guide," the melodious voice said, "you can display an equal trust." The big man looked into his goblet, and the mist-clad woman smiled faintly. "If you cannot trust us not to turn on you," the unseen woman continued, "then trust that we will be watching each other too closely to turn. You agreed to all of this, Samael. Why do you begin to quibble now?" Nynaeve gave a start as Birgitta touched her arm, and they were back among the wagons with the moon shining through the clouds. It seemed almost normal compared to where they had been.
"Why," Nynaeve began, and had to swallow. "Why did you bring us away?"
Her heart leaped into her throat.
"Did Mogadine see us?"
She'd been so intent on the other Forsaken, on the mingled strangeness and commonplaceness of them, that she had forgotten to keep an eye on Mogadine. She heaved a fervent sigh when Birgitta shook her head. "I never took my gaze from her for more than a moment, and she never moved a muscle. But I do not like being so exposed. If she had looked up, or one of the others." Nynaeve wrapped her shawl tightly around her shoulders and still shivered.
"Ravin and Samael."
She wished she did not sound hoarse.
"Did you recognize the others?"
Of course Birgitta had. It was a foolish way to phrase it, but she was shaken. Lanfear was the one hidden by her chair. The other was Grayndall.
Do not think her a fool because she lolls in a chair that would make a Senjay no room keeper blush. She is devious, and she uses her pets in rites to cause the roughest soldier I ever knew to swear celibacy.
Grandal is devious, Mokadine's voice said, but not devious enough.
Birgitta whirled, silver bow coming up, silver arrow almost flying to knock, and abruptly hurtled 30 paces through the moonlight to crash against Nynaeve's wagon so hard that she bounced back 5 and lay in a crumpled heap. Desperately, Nynaeve reached for Sidar. Fear streaked through her anger, but there was anger enough, and it ran into an invisible wall between her and the warm glow of the true source. She almost howled. Something seized her feet, jerking them backward and up off the ground. Her hands flew up and back until wrists met ankles above her head. Her clothes became powder that slid from her skin, and her braid dragged her head back until the braid rested on her bottom. Frantic, she tried to step out of the dream. Nothing happened. She hung doubled in mid-air like some netted creature, every muscle strained to its limit. Tremors ran through her. Her fingers twitched feebly, brushing her feet. She thought if she tried to move anything else, her back would break. Strangely, her fear was gone, now that it was too late. She was certain that she could have been quick enough, if not for the terror that had laced through her when she needed to act. All she wanted was a chance to put her hands around Mogadine's throat. Much good that does now. Every breath came in strained panting. Mogadine moved to where Nynaeve could see her, between the quivering triangle of her arms. The glow of Saidar surrounded the woman mockingly.
A detail from Grendal's chair, the Forsaken said.
Her dress was mist like Grendal's, sliding from black fog to nearly transparent, and back to gleaming silver. The fabric changed almost constantly. Nynaeve had seen her wear it before in Tanchico.
Not something I would have thought of on my own, but Grendal can be edifying.
Nynaeve glared at her, but Mogadine did not appear to notice.
I can hardly believe that you actually came hunting me. Did you really believe that because once you were lucky enough to catch me off guard, you might be my equal?
The woman's laugh was cutting.
If you only knew the effort I have put into finding you, and you came to me.
She glanced around at the wagons, studying the lions and bears for a moment before turning back to Nynaeve.
A menagerie? That would make you easy enough to find, if I needed to, now.
Do your worst, burn you, Nynaeve snarled, as best she could. Doubled up as she was, she had to force the words out one by one. She did not dare look straight toward Birgitta, not that she could have shifted her head enough to, but rolling her eyes as if caught between fury and fear, she caught a glimpse. Her stomach went hollow, even stretched tight as a sheepskin for drying. Birgitta lay sprawled on the ground, silver arrows spilling from the quiver at her waist, her silver bow a span from her unmoving hand.
Lucky, you say. If you hadn't managed to sneak up on me, I'd have striped you till you wailed. I'd have wrung your neck like a chicken.
She had only one chance, if Birgitta was dead, and a bleak one, to make Mogadine so angry that she killed her quickly in a rage. If only there was some way to warn Elaine, her dying would have to do it.
Remember how you said you'd use me for a mounting block? And later when I said I'd do the same for you? That was after I had beaten you, when you were whimpering and pleading for your life, offering me anything. You are a gutless coward. The leavings from a nightjar. You piece of...
Something thick crawled into her mouth, flattening her tongue and forcing her jaws wide.
You are so simple, Mogadine murmured. Believe me, I am quite angry enough with you already. I do not think I will use you for a mounting block.
Her smile made Nynaeve's skin crawl.
I think I will turn you into a horse. It is quite possible here. A horse, a mouse, a frog.
She paused, listening.
A cricket. And every time you come to Tel Irunriod, you'll be a horse, until I change it.
or some other with the knowledge does so. She paused again, looking almost sympathetic. No, I'd not want to give you false hope. There are only 9 of us now who know that binding, and you would not want any of the others to have you any more than myself. You will be a horse every time I bring you here. You will have your own saddle and bridle. I will even braid your mane. Nynaeve's braid jerked almost out of her scalp. You will remember who you are even then, of course. I think I will enjoy our rides, though you may not. Mogadine took a deep breath, and her dress darkened to something that glistened in the pale light. Nynaeve could not be sure, but she thought it might be the color of wet blood. You make me approach Semirag. It will be well to be done with you, so I can turn my full attention to matters of importance. Is the little yellow-haired chit with you in this menagerie? The thickness vanished from Nynaeve's mouth. I'm alone, you stupid pain. As if she had been beaten from ankles to shoulders, every stroke landing at once. She bellowed shrilly. Again. She tried to clamp her teeth shut, but her own endless shriek filled her ears. Tears rolled shamingly down her cheeks as she sobbed, waiting hopelessly for the next. Is she with you? Mogadine said patiently. Do not waste time trying to make me kill you. I won't. You will live many years serving me. Your rather pitiful abilities might be of some use once I train them. Once I train you. But I can make you think that what you just felt was a lover's caress. Now answer my question. Nynaeve managed to gather breath. No, she wept. She ran off with a man after we left Tanchico. A man old enough to be her grandfather, but he had money. We heard what happened in the tower. She was sure Mogadine must know of that. And she was afraid to go back. The other woman laughed. A delightful tale. I can almost see what fascinates Semirag about breaking the spirit. Oh, you are going to provide me with a great deal of entertainment, Nynaeve Almira. But first, you are going to bring the girl Elaine to me. You will shield her and bind her and bring her to lie at my feet. Do you know why? Because some things are actually stronger in Telairun Riod than in the waking world. That is why you will be a glossy white mare whenever I bring you here. And it is not only hurts taken here that last into waking. Compulsion is another. I want you to think of it for a moment or two before you begin believing it your own idea. I suspect that the girl is your friend. But you are going to bring her to me like a pet. Mogadine screamed as a silver arrow suddenly stuck its head out from below her right breast. Nynaeve fell to the ground like a dropped sack. The fall knocked every speck of breath from her lungs as surely as a hammer in the belly. Straining to breathe, she struggled to make racked muscles move, to fight through pain to Saidar. Staggering on her feet, Birgitta fumbled another arrow from her quiver. Go, Nynaeve! It was a mumbling shout. Get away! Birgitta's head wavered, and the silver bow wobbled as she raised it. The glow around Mogadine increased until it seemed as if the blinding sun surrounded her. The night folded in over Birgitta like an ocean wave, enveloping her in blackness. When it passed, the bow dropped atop empty clothes as they collapsed. The clothes faded like fog burning off, and only the bow and arrows remained, shining in the moonlight. Mogadine sank to her knees, panting, clutching the protruding arrow shaft with both hands as the glow around her faded and died. Then she vanished, and the silver arrow fell where she had been, stained dark with blood. After what seemed an eternity, Nynaeve managed to push up to hands and knees. Weeping, she crawled to Birgitta's bow. This time it was not pain that made tears come. Kneeling, naked and not caring, she clutched the bow. I'm sorry, she sobbed. Oh, Birgitta, forgive me! Birgitta! There was no answer except the mournful cry of a nightbird. Leandrin leaped to her feet as the door to Mogadine's bedchamber crashed open and the Chosen staggered into the sitting room, blood soaking her silk shift. Chesmal and Tamale rushed to her side, each taking an arm to keep the woman on her feet, but Leandrin remained by her chair. The others were out, perhaps out of Amador for all Leandrin knew. Mogadine told only what she wanted the hearer to know, and punished questions she did not like. "What happened?" Tamale gasped. Mogadine's brief look should have fried her where she stood.
"You have some small ability with healing," the Chosen told Chesmal thickly. Blood stained her lips, trickled from the corner of her mouth in an increasing stream. "Do it. Now, fool."
The dark-haired Gildanin woman did not hesitate in laying hands to Mogadine's head. Leandrin sneered to herself as the glow surrounded Chesmal. Concern painted Chesmal's handsome face, and Tamale's delicate fox-like features were contorted with pure fright and worry. So faithful they were, such obedient lapdogs. Mogadine lifted up onto her toes, head flung back. Eyes wide, she shook, breath rushing from her gaping mouth as if she had been plunged into ice. In moments it was done. The glow around Chesmal disappeared, and Mogadine's heels settled to the blue and green patterned carpet. Without Tamale's support, she might have fallen. Only a part of the strength for healing came from the power. The rest came from the person being healed. Whatever wound had caused all that bleeding would be gone, but Mogadine was surely as weak as if she had lain in bed an invalid for weeks. She pulled the fine gold and ivory silk scarf from Tamale's belt to wipe her mouth as the woman helped her turn toward the bedchamber door. Weak, and her back turned. Leandrin struck as hard as she ever had with everything she had puzzled out of what the woman had done to her. Even as she did, Sidar seemed to fill Mogadine like a flood. Leandrin's probe died as the source was shielded from her. Flows of air picked her up and slammed her against the paneled wall hard enough to make her teeth rattle. Spread-eagled, helpless, she hung there. Chesmal and Tamale exchanged confused glances, as if they did not understand what had occurred. They continued to support Mogadine as she came to stand in front of Leandrin, still calmly wiping her mouth on Tamale's scarf. Mogadine channeled, and the blood on her shift turned black and flaked away, falling to the carpet.
"You do not understand, great mistress," Leandrin said frantically. "I only wished to help you to have the good sleep."
For once in her life, slipping back into the accents of a commoner did not concern her in the least.
"I only..."
She cut off with a strangled gagging as a flow of air seized her tongue, stretching it out between her teeth. Her brown eyes bulged, a hair more pressure, and... "Shall I pull it out?" Mogadine studied her face, but spoke as if to herself. "I think not. A pity for you that the Almira woman makes me think like Semirag. Otherwise I might only kill you." Suddenly she was tying off the shield, the knot growing ever more intricate until Leandrin lost the twists and turns completely, and still it went on. "There," Mogadine said finally, in tones of satisfaction. "You will search a very long time to find anyone who can unravel that, but you will have no opportunity to search." Leandrin searched Chesmal's face, and Tamale's, for some sign of sympathy, pity, anything. Chesmal's eyes were cold and stern. Tamale's shone, and she touched her lips with the tip of her tongue and smiled. Not a friendly smile. "You thought you had learned something of compulsion," Mogadine went on. "I will teach you a bit more." For an instant, Leandrin shivered, Mogadine's eyes filling her vision as the woman's voice filled her ears, her entire head. "Live." The instant passed, and sweat beaded on Leandrin's face as the Chosen smiled at her. "Compulsion has many limits, but a command to do what someone wants to do in their inmost depths will hold for a lifetime.
You will live, however much you think you want to take your life. And you will think of it. You will lie weeping many nights, wishing for it. The flow holding Leandrin's tongue vanished, and she barely paused to swallow. Please, great mistress, I swear I did not mean... Her head rang, and silvery black spots danced before her eyes from Mogadine's slap. There are attractions to doing a thing physically, the woman breathed. Do you wish to beg more? Please, great mistress, the second slap sent her hair flying. More? Please, a third nearly unhinged her jaw. Her cheek burned. If you cannot be more inventive than that, I will not listen. You will listen instead. I think what I have planned for you would delight Semirag herself. Mogadine's smile was almost as dark as Tamale's. You will live, not stilled, but knowing that you could channel again if only you found someone to untie your shield. Yet that is only the beginning. Evan will be glad of a new scullery girl, and I am sure the Arene woman will want to have long talks with you about her husband. Why, they will enjoy your company so much that I doubt you will see the outside of this house during the years to come. Long years in which to wish that you had served me faithfully. Leandrin shook her head, mouthing no and please. She was crying too hard to force the words out. Turning her head to Tamale, Mogadine said, "Prepare her for them, and tell them they are not to kill or maim her. I want her always to believe she might escape. Even futile hope will keep her alive to suffer." She turned away on Chesmal's arm, and the flows holding Leandrin to the wall vanished. Her legs gave way like straw, crumpling her to the carpet. Only the shield remained. She hammered at it futilely as she crawled after Mogadine, trying to catch the hem of her shift, sobbing brokenly. "Please, great mistress!" "They are with a menagerie," Mogadine told Chesmal. "All of your searching, and I had to find them myself. A menagerie should not be too difficult to locate." "I will serve faithfully," Leandrin wept. Fear turned her limbs to water. She could not crawl fast enough to catch up. They did not even look back at her, scrabbling across the carpet after them. "Bind me, great mistress, anything. I will be the faithful dog." "There are many menageries traveling north," Chesmal said, eagerness to negate her failure filling her voice. "To Gildan, great mistress." "Then I must to Gildan," Mogadine said. "You will procure fast horses and follow." The bedchamber door closed on her words. "I will be the faithful dog," Leandrin sobbed in a heap on the carpet. Lifting her head, she blinked tears away to see Tamale watching her, rubbing her arms and smiling. "We could overwhelm her, Tamale. We three together could..." "We three?" Tamale laughed. "You could not overwhelm Fat Evan." Her eyes narrowed as she studied the shield fastened to Leandrin. "You might as well be stilled." "Listen, please." Leandrin swallowed hard, trying to clear her voice, but it was still thick, if burning with urgency, when she went on at frantic speed. "We have spoken of the dissension that must rule among the Chosen. If Mogadine hides herself so, she must hide from the other Chosen. If we take her and give her to them, think of the places we could have. We could be exalted above kings and queens. We could be chosen ourselves." For a moment, one blessed, wonderful moment, the child-faced woman hesitated. Then she shook her head. "You have never known how high to lift your eyes. Who reaches for the sun will be burned. No, I think that I will not be burned for reaching too high. I think that I will do as I am told, and soften you for Evan." Suddenly she smiled, showing teeth that made her even more vulpine. "How surprised he will be when you crawl to kiss his feet." Leandrin started screaming before Tamale even began.
Chapter 35 Ripped Away. Yawning, Elaine watched Nynaeve from her bed, her head propped up on one elbow and black hair spilling down her arm. It was really quite ridiculous, this insistence that whoever did not go to Tel Iron Riad remain awake. She did not know how long an interval Nynaeve had experienced in the world of dreams, but Elaine had been lying here for a good 2 hours, with no book to read, no needlework to do, nothing at all to occupy her except staring at the other woman stretched out on her own narrow bed. Studying the Eidom was no good. She thought she had wrung everything out of it that she could. She'd even tried a slight touch of healing on the sleeping woman, perhaps all the healing she knew. Nynaeve would never have consented to it awake. She did not think much of Elaine's abilities in that direction. Or maybe she would have in this case, but her black eye was gone. In truth, that was the most complicated healing Elaine had ever done, and it really had exhausted her skill. Nothing to do. If she had some silver, she might have tried making an eidom. Silver was not the only metal, but she would have to melt coins to get enough. The other woman would be less pleased at that than at finding a second eidom. If Nynaeve had been willing to tell Tom and Julin about this, at least she could have invited Tom in for conversation. They really did have the most delightful talks, like a father passing on his knowledge to his daughter. She had never realized that the game of houses was so deeply embedded in Andor, if thankfully not so deeply as it was in some other lands. Only the borderlands escaped it entirely, according to Tom. With the blight right to the north and Trolloc raids a daily fact, they had no time for maneuvering and scheming. She and Tom had wonderful talks, now that he was sure she was not going to try snuggling into his lap. Her face burned at the